Welcome back to Geeks Not at College, Geeks After College, because I'm Taylor and I'm standing in for Casey, who's up to his breasts in, schoolwork. So, Casey has breasts, right? Man breasts?
All four of them.
All four of them.
I was going to say he's like up to his breasts in breasts.
Whoa.
Just a breast sea of breasts. Or he's up to his schoolwork in breasts. Neither Whoa. Of those makes well. One of them makes sense. One the other one is just sense. Plain hog gibbery. I don't know.
But yeah, I figured I'd give the big ginger giraffe a break, since he's busy with finals and all, and it is his final quarter. So I God, thought it would be right. Yeah. See how fucking old we are. But I figured it'd be fun to do a alumni reunion. So I am Taylor, your host for the night. I'm joined by Neil.
Hey.
And Steven. And his plus one, a chicken sandwich.
Say hi, chicken sandwich.
Hey! Don't eat me! Don't eat me!
Me!
I have a wife and kids.
And let's have a moment of silence for Steven's plus one chicken sandwich.
Steven, can you go to a wedding? And in your plus one, you write chicken sandwich. But it's not just like a joke. It's not like just like a weird throwaway thing. Like you have to show up with a chicken sandwich, and you have to put like a little veil on it or something, and you have to talk to it, and then like you have to go and dance with it.
You have to like you put the sandwich on a plate at the table, and you walk up to it. And it's like, may I have this dance?
But then it like rejects you, and you like get really mad at it, and then you throw it across the room, and then it hits the bride,
and then like total eclipse of the heart starts, and then you like have a you reconcile your love for one another.
I don't know why, but like the filmmaker in me is just imagining this as like Steven getting mad, and you're like, no, well, fuck you, chicken bitch, and then like throwing it across the room, and then like it slows down, and then as it's going, you're like, dun, 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 turn around, every now and then again, and like, you know, like as it's passing people's like shocked faces, and like all in super slow motion,
like it's fucking The Usual Suspects,
yeah, and then like. As soon as it hits the bride's face, that's when like the chorus comes in, bum bum bum, and I need you now tonight. So basically,
can I just suggest a closing scene of this movie being the reveal of the invitation, where it says, "Chicken sandwich, you were cordially invited to the wedding. Are you coming with a guest?" Or
like, it's like the chicken sandwich's like sister getting married.
Like I think it's suggesting that Steven was the plus one.
No, I'm just saying, like, you know, Steven is the plus one, but
yeah, exactly.
Like, it's like the connection is that it's the chicken sandwich's like sister who's like a McRib.
Oh Jesus! And like oh my God. So like the chicken sandwich gets smeared all over the McRib. This sounds vague.
Call David Fincher right now.
God, this is a hotter movie than fucking 50 Shades of Grey.
This is a Robert Zemeckis scene, I'm just saying. This sounds vaguely pornographic.
I say this is hotter than 50 Shades of Grey, but then again, most shit is hotter than
I think everything's hotter than 50
literally, Shades. Literally a piece of shit is like hotter than 50 Shades of Grey.
A piece of shit filmed by David Fincher, yeah. It's going to be great.
Those Coca-Cola polar bears are hotter than 50 Shades of Grey.
That they are.
The fucking Arctic. I don't know.
Apple bottom jeans, faces with the fur. Anyway, that's totally how we plan to open this episode. Talking about Steven's fucking dinner.
I had a sandwich. It's not as fun. It was good, though.
I wish I had a piece of gum. So, anyway, the plan is we have a couple reviews, a couple movies to talk about, and we got some big news. You know, the Oscars just happened. Which is kind of a nice, convenient thing for us because we were planning to record this earlier, but, you know, then we figured why not just wait?
we were just really lazy, and then it was like, oh, well, I mean, the Oscars happened, so we could talk about that.
Por qué no las dos?
I don't speak your moon language.
You haven't seen that ad where it's like, do crispy or soft tacos? And it's like this little Mexican girl who's like, por qué no las dos? And then they like celebrate it. Like,
I love that one. It's yeah, great.
That's what that is. Anywho, sorry.
Well, we were going to have a whole like scripted episode like back on Saturday, but then we got lazy and it's like, ugh, let's just wait until the Oscars and then like, you know, that'll be there. The work will be done. So
yeah, I'll just have to
save us some time.
I'll just have to read. I mean, I have to learn how to read first, but you know, I just have to read stuff.
As someone who can read but chooses not to, it's very overrated.
Yes. Okay.
Sometimes it makes your eyes hurt.
I made the conscious decision to never read again after reading Atlas Shrugged.
Thank you, Officer Barb Brady.
You literally just shrugged and stopped reading.
Beautiful.
Ayn Rand, why is this still a thing? But to start off the episode, Neil and I are going to talk about a recently released movie that isn't 50 Shades of Grey called Kingsman. And
sexier than 50 Shades of Grey.
It's what?
It's sexier than 50
Shades. It is sexier. I would definitely endorse this movie over 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh my god, absolutely. It's great.
And that's the review, moving on.
Let's read some tweets.
Let's read some tweets. But yeah, this is going to be spoiler free because one, Steven hasn't seen it. And we want you guys to go out and see this, especially since it's been only out for a little over a week. But
Matthew Vaughn needs to keep working, so get it.
Neil, do you want to start us off and talk a little bit about Kingsman?
It was good.
But like, tell us some information about the movie.
Oh my god.
But you don't have me to summarize the movie.
Yeah,
I know. That was why I had you do it because
it's usually my job.
I can't do it, man. I can't do it. No, I'm good. I don't know. Where do you start off? The movie literally opens with...
Well, not even summarize the whole movie, just kind
of
like...
Oh, no, of course not. I was going to say the movie literally opens with two like special forces agents riding on a helicopter in the desert set to Dire Straits' Money for Nothing.
Hell yeah.
And at that moment, I leaned over to my brother and I said... I am fucking okay with this movie.
I kind of wanted to say the same thing to my dad, but I was just like, okay, let's do this.
It's like, I am won over, but I am won over. This is good.
I am so effing okay with this, Dad.
Yeah, I know, right?
You're gosh darn right this movie is good.
Yeah, you're right. Me and Dad are totally like Hank and Bobby Hill.
better fucking hope it's okay. I paid $25 to get in here.
This movie's pretty okay, I tell you what.
Let's see, Kingsman.
Who made Kingsman?
Kingsman was based
on
a comic.
Don't worry about the comic.
Was based on a Mark Millar comic. So right off the bat, ew. But it was.
He's written like one good thing, two good things, maybe.
Like two.
Hey, but they're good.
But it was also adapted and filmed by Matthew Vaughn and Jane Goldman, both of whom are famous for the film adaptation of Kick-Ass and X-Men First Class. And I am a big fan of Matthew Vaughn and Jane Goldman. They didn't get married. Although if I did have like a screenwriting team shipping contest, it'd definitely be them.
Mm-hmm. I just kind of imagine them like forming Voltron together into.
Oh my god,
Matthew Goldman.
That'd be amazing. but I am a big fan of both of them because, one, reading the comic of Kick-Ass and then actually seeing the movie, it's amazing to see like how much they improved over the source material because it seems to be kind of a controversial opinion for me, which is not, you know, it's not really that out of the ordinary. I am not a fan of the comics of Kick-Ass.
I like the first... few issues and then it just goes off the rails.
I like the first half of the first one and then it just turns into everything I hate. And then the movie like managed to avoid that by being really darkly funny and not so fucking juvenile and disgusting. Yeah. And being, you know, I never thought I'd say this, kind of lightweight as opposed to the comic. And Excuse me, and it's great. I always kind of view that Matthew Vaughn and Jane Goldman are two of the few screenwriters that seem to actually genuinely understand story structure and, like, how to, just basically, like, story structure. Like, you know, character development, introduce this at this. You know, here's how to get something done efficiently. And, you know, that's why I'm a big fan of them. So as soon as I saw that they were involved with Kingsman, like, I remember seeing the first trailer and thinking, well, this could be fun or it could be shit. And then I saw their names and was like, well, I'm going to go see it, so whatever.
You were pretty sold on the Red Band trailer, right?
Because it was amazing. It was, like, all the stuff they couldn't show you.
Well, one of the things that's really cool about Kingsman, and one of my favorite, like, little things, little facets about it, is that it's basically, like, something of an, not, like, a direct, like, answer to the recent Bond films, but because it definitely, like, references Bond films.
Yeah,
you know, you
kind of have to when it's about British spies.
Well, right? Exactly, you have to, and it totally is respectful to James Bond.
Yeah, you know? It's not just like Bond fucking sucks. It's like, well, yeah. Let's build on that.
And yeah, it's like it's giving itself, like, you know, a nice alternative. Like, I almost feel like this is the movie that Die Another Day wishes it was.
I can totally understand that.
Because Die Another Day is basically a Roger Moore 70s Bond film set in 2002 with Pierce Brosnan. Like, it's just too goofy, and it doesn't kind of accept its identity, you know? But you have this one where it's got a great mixture, not giving away too much, it's got a nice mixture of pathos and comedy, and it doesn't take itself too seriously, but it takes itself seriously enough for you to get invested.
That's and that's always been a big thing for me with Matthew Vaughn and his movies and whatnot, is that, you know, they don't take themselves too seriously, but, you know, it's not like they're just complete farces or anything. Like, you know, they take themselves seriously enough when they need to. And usually he balances that pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like Guardians of the Galaxy.
It is a little like that, except way, way more crude than Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, yeah. And I love that this is an R-rated movie.
Oh, like, yes.
It would make me angry if this was not R.
Because absolutely.
It earns its R rating and then some.
Oh,
and it uses it. It's not just like, oh, it's violence for violence sake. It makes it fun, like, you know, Kick-Ass was.
Yeah, exactly. I genuinely adore Kick-Ass. Like, I know that's another bit of a controversial movie with, like, you know, the third act kind of destroys everything the movie was working towards. Like, yeah, I won't disagree with you, but it's still a hell of a lot of fun.
It's still fun and doesn't leave you, like, hating what you just read, like, the comic.
Oh, God.
I did look it up, and Mark Millar does have more than two good things that he's written. It's just that the stuff that he's most famous for
is shit
like
Wanted,
you know,
and Kick-Ass.
Wanted and Kick-Ass and
Civil War.
Civil War, yeah, I mean, it's not Civil War's not a
what? It's one of those where, like, the ending's kind of
Yeah. Right. Well, like, Civil War isn't offensive.
No, it's not.
Wanted and Kick-Ass kind of go into offensiveness.
Yeah.
Like Superman Red Son is really good. I actually like Wolverine Old Man Logan a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, that's one of the, like, the best Wolverine stories, right?
Believe it or not, it came from Mark Millar.
Yeah, and it came from
Mark Millar. That was actually one of the ones I was thinking of. It was Red Son and Old Man Logan were the two that I was thinking of that were, like, good.
Yep. And I'm trying to think of
Civil War enough. I think I can see problems with it, but
I think my biggest problem with Civil War is that it comes into the same trope that, and I'll talk about my problems with Mark Millar for a second. And I'm not even going to go into, like, the whole, like, you know, PC, you know, I object to him for social reasons or anything. Here are my problems with Mark Millar, completely getting rid of the whole, like, offensiveness and whatnot, because I generally try not to go down that road. My problems with Mark Millar is that Mark Millar is a great writer when he wants to be.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Millar is great when he has a leash around him, someone like a choke chain, someone saying, don't do that. Mark Millar has this tendency to act to basically eschew, like, good plot development and, you know, good character development and seeing where they go. Like, getting rid of that in favor of what a 15-year-old who watches Vampire Hunter D would think was, like, the coolest thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like, that's exactly where Kick-Ass, the comic, goes so wrong. And just like all, like, you know, that's where it really has a problem. And Wanted, the comic, is basically just like the entirety of that. And that's why I liked Kick-Ass, the movie, so much, because Mark Millar a lot of times comes across to me as like some 15-year-old who just likes to say, you know, bad, like naughty words just to get a reaction from people, trying to impress the upperclassmen. And then Matthew Vaughn and Jane Goldman are the upperclassmen who are like, okay, we see what you're doing. You need to stop this, and we'll help. We'll tell you how to fix this, and we'll yeah. And that's kind of what Kick-Ass, the movie, is to me. That's like the biggest example of their dynamic.
Well, yeah,
at least in my eyes. Also, Mark Millar writes everyone as assholes. Everyone is assholes, and that's my problem with Civil War, is that everyone's just an asshole.
Yeah.
Did Mark Millar write The Ultimate?
Yes, he wrote. Yes, he wrote.
And then that's where the Avengers are all assholes, right?
Yes.
Yes. And he also wrote Ultimate X-Men. He had a huge, you know, hand in the Ultimate Universe. You know, he did Ultimate Fantastic Four. He had a run on Fantastic Four that was okay. That kind of tried to tie in stuff from like Old Man Logan and stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't know. He's a very mixed bag, and yeah. It's when he does stuff for the big two, it's generally not going to be like insulting your intelligence, you know.
Yeah.
Even like Steven said, like Civil War isn't that bad. It's just not very good.
I'm happy that they're adapting it, because then that means that possibly the same people who wrote Winter Soldier will get their hands on it and be like, oh boy, where do we start?
Yeah, we have good writers.
We have good writers.
And yeah. Not only that, but like, wasn't there I don't want to go too far off on the Captain America tangent, but I think there was that article that said like, oh, the title for Captain America 3 has been in mind for like 10 years now. So like they've been planning on doing Civil War for a long time. So they have plans for it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have, you know, devoted plans to it combined with the good writers of the Russos.
Yeah.
I think that they could adapt it into something decent.
That's kind of what I'm hoping for. So that's why I'm not too nervous about it or anything. I just worry that like the scale of it is going to be. I'm worried that it might turn into what Batman versus Superman is turning into.
Which is like,
you know, yeah, it's named Batman versus Superman, but you have everyone else. And I'm worried that Civil War, Captain America 3 is going to turn into like, yeah, Captain America 3, where Captain America is sort of in it. Like, you know, the Hobbit films. It's called The Hobbit, but The Hobbit is there sometimes.
Where it basically becomes like Avengers 2.5.
Yeah, I don't know if I want that. I mean, like, granted, if it's being written by the same guys who did Winter Soldier and it's being directed by the Russos, then I'm not that worried.
Yeah. Didn't the Russos write and direct it?
I think they had a hand in writing it, because they're actually pretty snazzy screenwriters, but I don't think they wrote it themselves. Actually, I'm going to take a look just to satisfy my own curiosity. Talk amongst yourselves.
But anyway, back to Kingsman.
The Underground Railroad was neither underground nor was it a railroad. Discuss!
I think it goes without saying that Neil and I both highly recommend Kingsman. It's funny that this is the second year in a row now that we've gotten a really nice big surprise movie in February. You know, after the Lego movie, now we got Kingsman. And they're very different movies to emphasize that. But
yes, they are.
Watch them back to back.
Yeah, they're a double feature.
So anyways, Kingsman. I really enjoy Kingsman. It is a hell of a lot of fun.
It also has probably one of my favorite sequences in a movie in a long, long time.
Absolutely, same here. I was telling everyone beforehand, I want to take Will and I want to take Steven here to go see it. Especially, I want to take Ryan to go see it.
Yes. Geeks to College's alumni Ryan.
Just for one scene in particular, and it will be the greatest thing ever. And that's why I wanted to do it on Sunday. But
you need to bring Ryan to see, like, you know, leaves blow on the ground. I mean,
he's like, oh!
watching Gone Girl with both Will and Ryan with the big reveal was, oh my god, just the highlight of my year.
Ryan is like an and one street hoop spectator at the movies, man.
He is a guy. He is a guy that, like, when two like black people are about to fight and they have their friends around them, like, oh shit, you know, like, in the back, like hyping them up. That's Ryan. All of them in one.
Yep.
Oh man, we watched a Jackie Chan movie a couple of nights ago. Man, that was badass.
I want to show Liz and Ryan Drive. Not because I think that, like, Liz is going to love it or anything, but the way that the film is paced and everything, and, like the, just the tension that ratchets up over it, you know, and then it just explodes in, like, little bits of violence. I want to be there with Ryan and Liz to see that, because Ryan and Liz are the dynamic duo of reacting to things. If you ever want to have, like, a great time, or if you ever want to see a movie that you've seen hundreds of times, but you want it to feel fresh, you show it to Liz and Ryan, and because they're going to make it feel wonderful.
And again, they have the prestigious title of dynamic duo of reacting to things.
Yeah, exactly.
Reacting to things. But we should also say who Liz is. Liz is Ryan's girlfriend, who is Liz.
The Monstar thing.
Yeah, Scoper Monstar, who was on several years ago for around Halloween time.
She is actually more famous than any of us.
Yeah, she is one of the, like, we've had like two guests, you know, we had her and Eddie Hileko from Face Off, and
yeah,
they're both pretty dang famous, more famous than us, but
yeah.
So
I'm okay with obscurity though for right now.
The most famous person on mic right now is my chicken sandwich.
Because it comes from a chain restaurant that everyone is familiar with. There you go. So anyways, Kingsman, it's really good. I think it might be, like, script-wise, I think it might be the weakest. No, I think X-Men First Class is probably, like, script-wise, the weakest effort from Vaughn and Goldman. But even then, it's still good. Like, it's not, like, it's definitely good.
Yeah, I almost want to say it's, like, pacing a little bit.
The pacing is a little off, but it's not, like, it's not, like, torturous or anything.
Because it takes a little while to get going. You know, you kind of have...
You're
almost like blue balled in the beginning. You're like, oh, like you keep having like glimpses of action.
Yeah.
But then you get like, you know, the one that's in the trailer with Harry Hart, aka Galahad, played by Colin Firth, where he fights the dudes in the bar and he throws the mug of beer with the umbrella. That's like the first true action scene in the movie.
And then
it just kind of escalates from there. And that's probably, what, like 25 minutes into the movie?
I think so. Yeah. I don't mind that so much because I like Casino Royale, the Daniel Craig Bond film, is actually one of my favorites precisely because of the pacing of it, where it's not just wall-to-wall action. It builds up to the action. Like the film, you know, like you get a whole bunch of character development, then you get plot development, and then you get an action scene. And then, you know, you get more plot development. You know, it takes its time and it makes you feel like you earned those action scenes, and one of my favorite things about Casino Royale, and I wish that a lot more action films followed that.
Well, and like the early Bond films had a lot of that too. I mean, even something that's kind of noted for being really over the top, like Goldfinger.
Yeah,
I mean, the first time that the two, you know, that Goldfinger and James Bond interact is during a fucking golf game. You know,
exactly.
But it's still pretty, like, you know, there's some witty banter between them. It's pretty tense. You know, you have the classic odd job throwing his hat. Sequence.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, if anything, Casino Royale is like a nice return to form of what, you know, because again, it's more, it's not a straight adaptation of the book, Casino Royale, but it's definitely, you know, closer to the books than they had been for decades.
Yeah, exactly.
Kingsman, I will say, I also think that the way they shoot the action is pretty fucking fantastic in this, because
the way they shoot the action. Yeah, it is so like slapdash and kind of delirious.
It is, but it works because
it does. It actually works really well.
It feels like the evolve, like the next step, like past like Hot Fuzz's editing and cinematography. It feels like if you gave them a little bit more money. Where you can tell what's going on. It's still, like, you feel like you're kind of in, like, a little bit of a fever dream, but you can tell what's going on.
Yeah.
It's a nice, it's a great answer and statement against, you know, too much shaky cam.
Yeah.
Because that's been a problem. Because it's like if shaky cam, like, went to college and got a nice education and actually became an upright citizen.
It's funny enough that you mentioned shaky cam and Matthew Vaughn movies. In Kick-Ass, the first Kick-Ass movie, the first scene where Kick-Ass goes to try to fight crime and he gets fucking stabbed.
Yeah.
Matthew Vaughn and the cinematographer, Ben Davis, who actually is now the cinematographer on both Guardians of the Galaxy and Avengers 2. So it's really cool to see how he's moved up.
Uh-huh.
When they were filming that, Ben Davis wanted, like, they the two of them got into an argument about how it should be filmed. Ben Davis said, you know, we need to shoot this handheld. I want to shoot this, like, you know, really shocking and gritty. And Matthew Vaughn was actually, like, the voice of reason saying, no, I want to shoot this straight. I want to shoot it, you know, like, tripod and Steadicam. And Ben Davis is like, why do you want to do that? That's, like, completely against everything this scene is about. And Vaughn said, I don't want the filmmaking to speak for it. I want the action itself to speak for it. Like, I want the content of what's going on screen to get its point across. I want that to speak for itself. And, you know, they shot it straight, you know, with tripods and Steadicams, and I think that the scene is great because of that.
Uh-huh.
Like, especially, like, the way things fold out, you know, the way that it's shot is so it's so opposing to how that scene eventually goes, and it works better because of it. So it's nice that you mention that, because there's actually a whole thing behind that with Matthew Vaughn. So it's cool.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I think that that's where we're at in terms of action movie cinematography.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, what would you say is, like, really the godfather of – the grandfather of shaky cam in action movies? Like, the Bourne trilogy?
The Bourne trilogy. But the thing is, the Bourne trilogy utilized that really well.
Yeah,
and
but
then
everyone
else was like, let's do that. Actually, no. Not the Bourne trilogy, the Godfather, like, when it first started becoming a thing?
Well, sure. I mean,
Saving Private Ryan.
Okay, Saving Private Ryan. Okay.
Because after that, you see it so much more.
Yeah. It's like, just because it, and
fucking
even
Matt Damon movies, man.
Yeah, it's true. He must be vomiting after every take, just like,
Matt Damon's the one behind it all. Illuminati.
Matt Damon.
Matt Damon.
I think a lot of it is just it. Even though they do it well, it's still like something of a negative influence. You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
to me, it just feels so lazy.
Well, that's like what I mean. It's like the Bourne trilogy and Saving Private Ryan do it right. They put the time in, and they get it right. And then you have a lot of these movies that are just trying to cash in on it, or just kind of do it because it's popular and it doesn't really need it. Like, I know that's what people complain about with, like, the first Hunger Games movie.
The first Hunger Games movie, I can understand the, like, some of it, because, and I've had many a conversation about this. The first Hunger Games movie, they filmed it the way they did, it was a deliberate choice, not because, like, hey, shaky cam's the new thing, but you have a movie about kids killing kids, and it has to be PG-13. You cannot make it R. You cannot show them killing kids. So you have to imply it. And in that sense, I mean, like, it is tough to watch, but, you know, you really – that they did about the best they could with that situation. So I'm actually one of the few people to be more lenient towards it. And the shaky cam bothers me less and less as the film goes on. I know that it kind of bothered me at first at the beginning of the film where they're in District 12. But I understood it as, like, more and more to try to give the film, like, a really claustrophobic feeling.
Yeah.
Like, there's no sense of direction or geometry. Or, sorry, there's no there's no sense of geography in any of the scenes. And, like, that really bothered me at first. But then it's like, oh, wait, this place is supposed to be, like, really claustrophobic. Okay. And I got that. Like, I thought that was actually kind of cool. Granted, they could have cut down on some of the editing, because even to me, sometimes it's not so much the shaking cam as much as it is just, like, the throw it in a blender editing style.
Well, that just exacerbates the problem. And it's almost
It's really become evident in, like, the Liam Neeson action films directed by Olivier Megaton. I hate those. Like, Taken 2 and 3, nonstop.
what was that one where, like, with him and January Jones that I can't even remember?
Oh, I know that one.
Yeah, like, that one was a big problem, too. Like, I just do not like his films because of that. It's just such a, like I said, it's like they just throw in all the footage, all the dailies into a blender, and they're like, all right, here you go.
Yeah.
It's awful. I hate it. Sorry.
And I guess people are just sick of shaky cam because you do have people that have motion sickness. So I can understand just being like, wow, I can't enjoy this movie just because of like a physical reaction I have to this type of cinematography. I don't.
The movie theater where you're sitting like in a chair facing a screen should be like the last place you feel motion sickness.
Yeah, yeah. Literally not moving at all.
I did get around that though when I saw Cloverfield for the second time. I figured out how to get around that. Sit in the very back of the theater.
Mm-hmm. What? I mean, granted, I can't sit on in the very front and just like basically just be on a bed looking up at a giant, like, you know, in perspective warped screen.
I would actually intentionally sit in front if they had beds.
Well, yeah, but
fill my body with popcorn through this IV.
Oh no, it's clogging up. Why didn't you?
Into my veins.
It was supposed to be a pure liquid. No!
Somebody put Whoppers in the popcorn.
Fuck. Anyway.
That'd be awesome. But yeah, shaky cam is so lazy, and I hate it. And it seems like people are getting past that now, and I'm so fucking happy.
It'd be cool, because you have movies like Captain America 2 and The Avengers and most Marvel movies, you know, that just, they don't, they might do quick editing, like quick cuts and stuff to make it move faster, but, you know, they just, you know, set up a shot, they use a steady cam or something, and you get to see all of it. I mean, that's one of the great things about Captain America 2 is just how, like, really how solid
fluid it is.
How fluid, yeah. Like, and it's not done, you know, with annoying quick editing or shaky cam.
I will bring up two examples. Or one example to compare with Captain America Winter Soldier, which is the first Thor movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the night and day aspect of that.
Literally,
like,
because that movie quality. Was really dark.
It really fucking was. It really was. Like, Thor. I like the cinematography for Thor. Like, I love the Dutch angles and whatnot. Like, I love the anamorphic lenses. I love the wide lenses and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Because it really gives it that over-the-top Shakespearean feeling to it. Like, I love that aspect of it.
Yeah.
I do not like the fight scenes because, and I've talked about this with my problems with the first Thor movie, which are, you know, like it's got a lot of high highs, it's got a lot of low lows.
It's very much hills and valleys.
It is a very frustrating experience, but I prefer that to actual boredom.
Yeah.
So I won't say too much, but the fight scenes in Thor are really, really awful because, okay, so you imagine like these gods.
Would you say they're as bad as the fight scenes in the movie license video game based on that movie?
Oh my god.
I haven't played that.
It's so bad.
Is this really a thing?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Like, Marvel stopped doing the movie license games after like Iron Man 2 or something like that.
Yeah, Iron Man 2 is just god fucking awful. Oh for a movie
Iron
that
Man
came out
was
in...
terrible. The Incredible Hulk's one was just a watered down Ultimate Destruction, which probably made it the best of the Marvel games.
Yeah.
I remember the Hulk one being pretty good.
Yeah, it was watered down Ultimate Destruction.
Yeah, it's a formula that's like hard to fuck up, where you just have the Hulk jump around and beat.
Like the Thor one just had like, what is it? You just basically hit like two buttons. And there's like no real combos or anything or something like it. It just was really repetitive. And
this is really a thing.
Angry
oh my God.
Yeah, look
Angry
up footage
does
of it.
A review of it.
Yeah. I thought you guys were fucking with me.
No, and look up footage of Iron Man 2. It is amazingly awful. The graphics are terrible.
Don Cheadle looks like some racist's like napkin sketch.
He looks like a character out of fucking Bamboozled or some shit. It's like, oh it's god, so this is awful and offensive.
I gotta check that out.
And it's like, this was 2010, you know.
Yeah,
this was just under like 5 years ago where there was like other great games coming out, like, you know, Mass Effect 2 just came out.
You know what else came out that year? Bioshock 2. That's a pretty good looking game. There's no excuse.
Bioshock 2, yeah, because Sega.
I'll champion Bioshock 2. I mean, it's not as good as either of the other two in the series, but I think it's a perfectly good game. But anyways, sorry, off topic.
Thor. We were talking about the Thor fight
scenes. Anyways, the fight scenes in Thor. Okay, when you think about gods, demigods, and, you know, ice giants fighting each other, you think of, like, this really insane, like, choreography, like, you know, just, oh, I can't comprehend, like, just how awesome it would be, like, you know, just, like, these epic beings fighting each other.
Hold on.
That's, what's up?
Just continue talking.
Continue talking about the disappointment of the movie.
Oh, okay. I will gladly do that. And like, that's like, the coolest thing to see. Like, you know, you can't wait to imagine how they're going to do this. No, instead they film it all on, like, I don't know, 85 millimeter lenses, you know, portrait lenses, which, you know, there's no sense of geography there. So, you know, you can't tell what's going on. It's all shaky and it's really quickly, like, haphazardly cut together with no sense of rhythm or direction. And it's just awful. Like, I can't tell what's going on. I want to see these people fight, and instead it's just a giant mash of things. And of course they light the thing too low, and you can't see anything literally, and, you know, because of the lighting, it's just terrible. So the only excuse I can think that they would possibly go with is that, oh yes, these immortal beings are fighting each other, and us, our mortal eyes just cannot comprehend it, which I would say is stupid.
Oh my god, did anyone actually say that?
No, but I imagine that that's what someone would try to say, like, you know,
oh,
some guy on IMDb. Yeah, like some like Marvel, like, neckbeard guy, you know, who's like, you just don't understand it. Our mere mortal eyes, we can't comprehend the two titans fighting each other. You know, I don't know.
MySpace.
Giant brain girls on MySpace. Yeah, you better believe I didn't forget about that. So that's kind of what I'm getting from it, and it's frustrating as hell. So you compare those fight scenes, which are arguably some of the worst that Marvel has ever done, to Captain America: Winter Soldiers, which does have handheld, but it's all, like, really well staged, and, you know, there's geography to
there's,
it.
So there's,
you know,
great coverage too.
There's great coverage. Oh my god! And, like, all the cuts, you know, flow one right into the other. It's the same thing that I praise the editing in the Bourne Ultimatum, like the Bourne Supremacy, you know, to an extent, but Bourne Ultimatum. There's a reason it won Best Editing at the Oscars, because the editing in those scenes, there, I never really have a problem telling what's going on. Because the cutting in those films, in those scenes, always, they're always directing your eyes to exactly where they need to be. And so, like, I have no problem processing what's going on. There's a reason it won that Oscar.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if it was the same guys who cut that. But that's why Winter Soldier's fight scenes are so good. And also, they're, like, almost all practical stunts.
Yeah, that's another thing, too.
Also, Winter Soldier straight up kicks a dude into a plane's engine. Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
Yep.
There's, like, straight up murder in that movie.
And Kingsman.
And Kingsman. So, anyways.
Bringing it back around.
I think we talked more about the Marvel Cinematic Universe than Kingsman itself.
Because that doesn't. Because we can't spoil that, really.
So. I know.
It's par for the course for geeks at college.
This is true. But at least it was informative. So, yeah. At least there's that.
Well, at least it's related. We talked about editing and how you have the editing and cinematography of Matthew Vaughn films, including Kingsman.
So. We also talked about Steven's chicken sandwich, which I am sure chicken sandwiches were eaten both by people on set of Kingsman and by people watching Kingsman.
I know I did. But that's Kingsman. Sometimes I like the fuck. Do you want to give it a rating?
You had to appeal to the chicken sandwich eating demographic.
Yeah, man.
Of which I am a proud part of.
That's a key demographic in the Nielsen ratings, man.
It is.
So, Neil, what would you rate Kingsman?
At the moment, I would definitely give it, like, an 8 out of 10, just out of sheer enjoyment. Like, I'm sure there are problems with it. I mean, like, there's some pacing issues.
But it's a good movie it's a good example of a movie that distracts you from its problems.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's some shoddy special effects work, which also seems to be a staple of Matthew Vaughn films, which is not exactly something I'm fond of, but you just sort of learn to live with it.
Like, what was it was like 81 million was Kingsman.
Yeah, that was the budget, which is actually pretty good.
For as good as it looks, and for I'm kind of okay with some of the effects. Because
it gives
it gives it this kind of, it gives it a really unique feel to it.
Yeah, because you got,
like, it gives it a personality.
There's some kind of goofy, like green screen work.
It's not as bad as the green screen in X-Men First Class. There was some unforgivable shit in there.
Sure. I'm just saying, like, but there's some stuff, like, there's some, like, you know, you have the shot of, like, the plane coming in with, like, the rockets, which is very, very not the best. But at the same time, it feels
kind of charming.
Well, it's charming and it feels appropriate given that it's a very British production.
Yeah.
And the British stuff typically has, you know, smaller production values than American stuff. You know, we're kind of spoiled, you know, with stuff. But it's like you look at a show like, you know, Doctor Who,
like Christopher Eccleston era Doctor Who.
Yeah, or even current Doctor Who. You know, it's like they still have.
That's true.
They have to be pretty, you know, smart and economic with their effects.
Yeah.
So even when they have, you know, pretty elaborate, you know, starscapes and whatever, even in the Matt Smith years, they're still. You know, you're not going to be like, oh, man, this is so realistic, but it's charming.
It gets the thing done. Yeah, it has a personality. It's charming.
Yeah.
I once read an article bashing Matt Smith era, Stephen Moffat era Doctor Who for saying that the special effects were too good.
What?
Yes. It turns out that was in 2012. I did not know that that would be par of the course for online journalism. I thought that was just a fluke. Now it's every other article. I'm sorry. Anyways.
Thanks, Salon.com or whatever. Oh,
so many more.
But anyway.
But yeah, you get it.
So, I'd give Kingsman probably an 8, maybe an 8.5.
Okay, yeah.
Just for how much fun I had with it.
I'm really curious to see how it holds up on, like, repeat viewings, because Kick-Ass really, like, is just so much fun on repeat viewings.
Well, it has one of my favorite... I want to watch it again just to get more of the visual gags in, Harry's office.
Yes.
Because Harry has all these front page newspapers hanging up. And what do they represent? They're like days that
They are dates that he did something really important for the Kingsman service. Like, you know, like when he saved a queen from being assassinated or something. Or like, oh, he prevented like a bomb from blowing up in like a really populated area.
Yeah, and some of them are like, you know, genuine... like I think it's like Daily Sun or something like that.
Yeah, they're like tabloid headlines, and of course the point of that being, you know, it's a humbling experience. It's a humbling exercise, saying that, you know, it's a very thankless job. You know, like what you do will never be known by other people. Like, hey, the one time that you know you brought down an entire terrorist clan, the newspaper headline the next day is going to be fucking Brad Pitt ate my sandwich.
Yes, that is my favorite joke in the movie.
That is my favorite joke.
And it's going to be the name of this episode. I don't fucking care what you guys say.
Dude, no, I wholeheartedly encourage it.
Kings of College, episode 115, Brad Pitt ate my sandwich.
That'll get us so many views because people will be like, Brad Pitt!
Sandwiches!
Ooh, Brad Pitt senpai sandwiches!
I mean...
Again, we're hitting on the sandwich demographic.
Here. Sandwich senpai is a very
important demographic.
Exactly.
And it is, and a very delicious demographic.
Mhm. So, and that's another thing you mentioned about, like, there's actually a lot of really awesome morals in this movie. You know, not like cheesy ones, but it's like you bring up the whole like the humbling thing, like don't do it for the praise or any of that. And there's also the whole thing about, you know, manners maketh the man, you know, and it's not about I'm trying to remember the,
Oxford, not brogues,
not Oxford's not that quote, but, the quote that, Hart gives him, I'm blanking on it.
Something about like a gentleman doesn't look down on others, but he looks down on the man that he was.
Exactly. It's, what's this, the author's name? It's Hemingway. It's a Hemingway quote.
Yeah.
Which
I butchered, but you know, the same thing.
Fucking don't be a douchebag to other people, but be a douchebag to your old self, Hemingway.
Yeah. Ernest Hemingway, he wrote on a sandwich.
He wrote about a sandwich, an old sandwich in the sea.
He wrote it on a sandwich.
The old man in the sandwich. That's his.
It did not go over well with general audiences, so his editors made him take it back and rewrite it. written by. He tried to make it into a sea sandwich, but that didn't make sense.
Written by Ernest Borgnine Hemingway.
He was drunk the whole time.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was just thinking about making like a fried sausage and egg sandwich.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
And I got really excited.
And a little, like 3/4 chub.
No, I just went full chub, just saying.
Oh, okay. You know, whatever.
I'm not even...
It's your choice, man, whatever you want to do with the chub. It's all good.
I'm not ashamed. I can just say it.
And on that note, Kingsman. If what we have told you... If you're on the fence before, hopefully we have sold you on the movie and you want to check it out. I think it's made $155 million worldwide so far.
That's good. That means Matthew Vaughn can keep making movies.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's double the budget almost.
Yeah. There you go.
So
it's great.
Matthew Miller.
It's made about 67 domestic.
That's good.
Here in the States.
And it will still do fine. It'll do fine.
Yeah, let's see.
So it seems to have a proportionately better legs than a 50 Shades of Grey.
Well, absolutely. So fucking happy that it does.
Yeah.
Really. I am so genuinely happy about that.
Yeah.
Because this is the movie that everyone should be seeing and not that movie.
Yeah.
And
they should be eating sandwiches.
And eating sandwiches.
Do they eat sandwiches in 50 Shades of Grey? No. Therefore, so. Don't see it.
It's not 50 Sandwiches of Grey.
It's not 50 Shades of Sandwich Meat.
Yeah. Which, that sounds weird, but yeah.
Salami, pastrami.
It's 50 Shades of Brie.
50 Shades of Brie.
That's pretty all right. That's okay with me.
Good on you, Ingram. But anyway, that wraps up our talk on Kingsman, and we can move on to another movie. I'm the only one that's seen this movie, but I am definitely open to discussing it a bit.
We will
call you out on having seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is, dicks. Of course, the very successful and controversial American Sniper, directed by Clint Eastwood and starring Bradley Cooper. First off, I'm going to say a lot of the controversy surrounding this film, I believe, is more... I don't even know, and I know Neil pretty much confirmed this for me, but a lot of people that are criticizing this movie haven't even fucking seen it.
Yeah.
Which is stupid, just in general, for anything.
That's the climate nowadays, though.
But that's so stupid, go fucking see it.
Of course it's stupid, okay. It's just the way it is.
We just criticize 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, but that's just, fuck that's that different. Movie.
That's different.
That's totally different because that's not,
Did Bradley Cooper eat his fake baby in American Sniper?
I'm pretty sure there are sandwiches eaten in American Sniper.
You mistook
Thank you very
it for
much.
A sandwich.
There's a barbecue scene. Is there a sandwich eating barbecue scene in 50 Shades of Grey? No. Therefore, we can criticize it.
Baby, the other white meat.
Also, for the record, none of us are willing to even pirate that movie.
Yeah, pretty much. Let's be honest. We all got points for Fifty Shades of Grey, just solely on the point of no one should see this movie.
Because we weren't sure if Aaron Taylor Johnson, the son husband of the director of 50 Shades of Grey,
the child bride of Sam Taylor Johnson,
basically, he's the child. He's a little older than us. And she's the age of our parents, basically. Yeah.
It's also,
he's actually a little younger than we are.
I don't need to hear this.
Aaron, Aaron,
24.
Oh God.
Aaron Taylor Johnson.
Aaron
Me Johnson.
I'm not downloading 50 Shades of Grey. I mean, I'm the one that bought Chris's gag gift last year, that American Carol, super conservative airplane movie.
Yeah.
And, my Amazon, recommended list has just never been the same.
Yeah, ever since I bought a green screen for a filming project, for a project for Scream Factory, they will not stop recommending me fucking green screens. I only needed one, Amazon. That was it. Stop it.
I don't know. Most of my stuff, it is stuff that I've heard from respected sources about 50 Shades of Grey. One of us's very own, Brian Salisbury, has a very good review about it.
I think Brian Salisbury was a little more out for the throat than I think I would ever be about 50 Shades of Grey, but I could see where he was coming from on a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you're talking about something that, you know, deals with such potential themes as abuse and domestic abuse and whatever.
Yeah.
Well, I remember, are we talking about American Sniper or 50 Shades of Grey?
Well, I don't want to make this a big thing. I want to go back to American Sniper, but
I was talking about
Stephen all had to be like, "You're a hypocrite."
I was talking about American Psycho.
Yeah, too bad 50 Shades of Grey is not American Psycho.
It's funny that we mentioned American Psycho, and this was actually kind of intentional. Brett Easton Ellis.
That I mentioned American Psycho because I want to talk about this.
No, the author of American Psycho, Brett Easton Ellis, actually launched a campaign for him to be able to write the screenplay to the movie of 50 Shades of Grey.
And he'd probably pull a Matthew Vaughn and what's your face that wrote.
Make it fucking better.
Yeah, make it better.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, Gus Van Sant actually campaigned to direct the film, too. Like, he actually directed a staged scene of the first sex scene of the movie, which I don't know why, but I kind of want to go look for that just because it's a Gus Van Sant sex scene. That should
It's basically just Jerry.
Yeah, fuck off. I'm not doing this.
But anyway.
There's a reason that I bring that up, and it's because I feel that a lot of my problems come from that is not necessarily because I know that Steven and I talked about this. It's not that it's like kink shaming or anything, because it's not that at all. It's the problem that people from the kink community are like, this is actually a very negative portrayal. Like, this is not what we're about at all. And it's going to give people the idea that it's okay to do this, and it's not. So it's not necessarily like shaming people for liking BDSM and everything. It's the people from that actual community saying, this paints us very poorly and is not actually what we're about.
And the rather misogynistic whole thing about Christian Grey's behavior and how
you know, that's not okay. Like
it's just icky and not okay.
Yeah, here's the thing:
we just have to hope that the women seeing, or that the people in general seeing this. I know, like, a lot of people get crap for, or a lot of people are like, it's not just like, stop blaming women for what, like, liking a stupid movie or whatever, but we just got to hope that the people seeing this movie can separate fantasy from reality.
And that's what I'm hoping. That's what I'm really hoping.
And then go see Kingsman.
Or go watch
Kingsman. Eat a sandwich.
Eat a sandwich. Whatever. You know They're what? Both more productive.
You know what? Fuck movies. Just eat sandwiches.
All day, every day.
That's what I do. Or they could go watch
also
Secretary.
Using How I Met Your Mother slang for eating a sandwich, by the way.
I was actually just going to eat a sandwich. You guys are gross.
You guys are gross.
You people are disgusting. No, you would hope that people would be able to, like, separate, you know, what's right and what's wrong. Or, like, you know, like, right, hey, this isn't okay. That's the thing, though, that I always kind of rag on this. If this book or movie were fucking responsible, it would understand that Christian Grey's tendencies are that of a fucking serial killer.
Yeah. Mm.
And it doesn't go with that at all. Even if the book at any point was like, this is not okay, and, like, actually run with, you know, like, Christian is getting worse and worse, and, like, Anastasia actually has a fucking character arc where she's like, I have self-respect for this, and I cannot do this, and I need to fight back or something.
Yeah, and kicks his ass, and then wins.
And she, like, kicks his ass, like, J-Lo and Enough. I don't know. Yeah. But that never happens.
Like, J-Lo and Enough. Yeah, really?
Yeah. You missed my weird...
Your,
like,
fucking obscure ass shittily titled movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Or,
I'm not saying it's a good movie.
Like, more like Enough J-Lo and less like Boy Next Door J-Lo.
Oh,
hey,
shit.
I'm making a little bit of money off that movie right now.
That is also true.
And to be fair, I am also hoping that she gets nominated for a Razzie. So.
Oh, I can bet on it. I think it's going to happen. Yeah. Excuse me. But anyways,
you're welcome. American Sniper.
I was just gonna say, with, like, 50 Shades of Grey and whatnot, like, if, like, when I first saw the trailer for it, I actually thought it was a trailer for an adaptation of a film called, what was it, like, The Monster Beside Me, which is about a woman. I don't remember the name of the author, but she's, like, a famous crime author. And what happened was, she actually worked right next to a man who ended up being Ted Bundy, and like her relationship with him and like how he was just like seemingly a normal guy and how things got like fucked up. And like that was what I initially thought it was. I was like, oh, they made the book out of The Monster Beside Me. Oh, it's 50 Shades of Grey. Well, all right. Mm-hmm. Like I would respect it so much more if the book at any point was like, this is not okay and Christian Grey is practically a fucking serial killer and like run with it. But instead they don't. And also Anastasia Steele is just a horrible, like a horribly fucking boring character. So, like there's even... no, like,
preface at the beginning of 50 Shades of Grey or anything?
What's that?
There's no like preface or...
You mean preface?
Like no. Kind of disclaimer at the beginning of the book or anything?
No. I do have... No, exactly not. There's a difference between like, you know, like something that we're going to talk about with American Sniper, which is how, you know... Like portrayal is not, you know, condoning. It's not approval of it. But you know, and like you know, it could be like Mad Men, you know, where you show like a whole bunch of fucking awful behavior from the protagonists, but the creators and whatnot, you know, expect you to know that this is not okay.
Yeah.
And you just run with it. But 50 Shades of Grey does not have that at any point. And that's what bothers me about it, is that at no point does it ever say, like, you know, hey, you know, this is wrong, and I'm going to trust you to be able to make that decision. Like, the book is actively like, you know, no, this is okay. It's like, eh, it's not.
Nope.
So, yeah, Christian Grey is a serial killer, and they should have run with it because it would have been a much more interesting movie.
Yep.
And, yeah. So, anyways, 50 Shades of Grey. American Sniper. Sandwiches.
American Sniper, wee!
What kind of sandwiches do you think Chris Kyle ate?
I don't know. Freedom sandwiches?
What would be in a freedom sandwich?
Freedom?
I'm thinking like ham, salami, tomatoes, and crushed up DVD copies of American Sniper.
Oh my god.
It is terrible for your insides. You might as well be eating like fiberglass insulation.
You might as well be eating that like Krusty the Clown cereal that, you know, gave Bart appendicitis that one episode.
Yes. But really what happens is it crushes up your insides so much that it makes you literally piss red, white, and blue.
Oh my god.
American sandwich.
Where your blood is freedom. Like so fucked up that it doesn't even change to red when exposed to light.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Freedom sandwich.
Freedom sandwich. Oh my god. Speaking
of freedom sandwiches, I think Anthony Mackie is confirmed to be in Avengers too.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
like, there's
exciting.
There's an article saying Mackie, Hayley Atwell, and Idris Elba have been confirmed.
Yay what? For me!
Well, that's good for everyone with points there.
Yay!
I think Anthony Mackie has another movie or two this year, so...
Does he really? Well, he's already had Black and White, which I made sure to avoid like the plague.
That might have been it. Okay.
Yeah. I made sure to avoid that like the plague.
Whenever I hear Black and White, I just keep thinking that it's like a fucking Katy Perry song. Then I just think, oh yeah, it's like Hot and Cold.
Yeah,
well, it's a Michael Jackson song. Yeah.
No, that's a good song, though.
Yeah, Bunny.
It's a music video with Macaulay Culkin and George Wenton, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, it's a good song. Gotta make fun of a bad song.
I mean, we could, but...
We could.
That's not fun.
Anyway, American Sniper, yay!
American Sniper, there you go.
Anyway, so, yes, this is a movie very much that... And I'm not going to say, I'm just going to say it right out of the back. I think it is a movie that is getting a bunch of undeserved, both like, it's getting undeserved things from both fronts. It's getting undeserved praise, I think. I don't think it deserved the 6, I believe, Oscar nominations it got. I think the only one I would probably agree with is like maybe sound editing, which it ended up winning for.
Yeah.
And yeah, Bradley Cooper deserved to be nominated. I'm going to rescind my response from... our Oscar episode, but I still think he's probably one of the weaker people. I still think because the real thing that we were talking about when we were talking about in that episode about acting is who would you take out to put in, like, you know, either like Jake Gyllenhaal or David Oyelowo, you know, the snubs basically. He might be the first on the chopping block, or maybe Ethan Hawke, or is he supporting?
I think he was supporting.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I would take Ethan Hawke out, put Steve Carell, who was in lead,
and put him in.
Yeah, just because, fuck you, I don't care.
he was a supporting character.
Was Steve Carell's actually a supporting character? That's right, you have seen Foxcatcher.
See? I actually have seen
Foxcatcher. There you go, Steven, we have confirmation.
So he's not the main character?
He is not.
Really?
Bam.
He is not.
All the trailers focus on him.
Well, see, I still say that, like, there's, like, two very different trailers. There's, like, the first, like, announcement trailer that's the one I saw the most of. And then, the ones you saw that are, like, vastly different.
Well, because Steve Carell is probably the best-known character in there, or best-known actor in there, aside from Channing Tatum.
Yeah.
And Mark Ruffalo, man.
And Mark Ruffalo. But Channing Tatum definitely probably has, like, the most, like, star power right now. But it's him playing so against type that I guess they have to go with a different front, which is, look at Steve Carell's transformation.
Yeah. Well, he's got, like, you know, he's got a bunch of makeup on. He's playing really against type, like you said.
Yeah.
This is kind of, not in a bad way, but kind of par for the course for both, you know, Channing Tatum and Mark Ruffalo. But for Steve Carell, it's like, holy fuck. You know?
It's very unexpected. And it's probably the most showy of them, even though I would never call anything in Foxcatcher showy, because it's a very austere, downplayed movie, which is one of the things I always love about Bennett Miller's films. Mm-hmm. Like, it started with Capote, traveled over to Moneyball, and then there you go. Foxcatcher.
With American Sniper. Yeah, like, I think Bradley Cooper does a really good job. I think he is by far, it's very much like what we've talked about, what we've heard about, like, the Theory of Everything, where, you know, the very, very much the highlight of that movie is Eddie Redmayne and Still Alice, which that very much is the, like, Julianne Moore is very much the highlight of that movie.
From what I understand, yeah.
From what I've heard. And I would say that it's maybe not as much in this one. I don't know. It's a solid movie. I might as well just say, like, I'd probably give it, like, a 6.5, maybe a 7. Not super enthusiastic about it, but I think it's worth watching. But, one, you should see it before you comment on it, because I think a lot of it is, you know, you have the book that the movie's based on, American Sniper, and when this movie came out, there was a lot of talk about how there was a lot of Islamophobia in the book.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure there is. I'm not saying that there is or isn't, you know, I'm just going off of what people have said. I will say I believe they definitely toned that down a bit in this movie. I think there's only, like, one of the big quotes they use when they were talking about the book is that he referred to, you know, Muslims as savages a lot, which is unfortunate. I think that only happens, like, once in the movie. And the other thing that should be pointed out is that they don't necessarily paint Chris Kyle as this infallible person. They really don't, and they shouldn't because the guy's going through PTSD.
Yeah.
You know, and with that comes, you know, a lot of mixed emotions and mistakes and all sorts of stuff, and it's very much, I would say probably my biggest criticism of the film is that it doesn't focus so much. It doesn't focus quite enough for my taste, really, and for the movie's betterment, I would really say, on him post, you know, Iraq War.
Yeah,
a good chunk of the movie is very much, you know, it's told very linearly, where it's like we start when he's a young kid. His dad tells him this thing that's like, there's three types of people, son. And, you know, there's the wolf, the sheep, and the sheepdog, and, you know, and it's all about how you know, he becomes the sheepdog to protect the sheep, kind of thing. The sheeple, if you will.
Oh, shut up.
But, and then we go through him, you know, he's a rodeo bull rider, and then he, you know, hears about, I think it was, like, in Fallujah when the embassy was blown up. I think pre-9/11 this was. And the time in the beginning is very weird because, you know, Chris Kyle was born, I believe, in 1973. So he was 1974. So he was like 30 when he enlisted. So he was old for that whole thing. And so it's like, okay, 30 years. So 2004, which, you know, that's right in the heat of the Iraq War. But then, like, when he's at his base, I might have misheard it. He said almost 30. I don't know. But there is a part where because he goes into the Navy SEALs. He becomes a Navy SEAL, and during basic training, that's where he meets his to-be wife, and, you know, their romance happens, blah, blah, blah. And there's a shot where, you know, they're together. He's, you know, going through basic training, in supposedly 2004, maybe, but then you see footage of 9/11. Like 9/11 happens, and so it's kind of confusing when the hell everything's taking place up to that point. So it's there's some weird storytelling issues there.
Yeah.
But they don't paint him as, and it's not like super pro-war jingoistic either. I think people that are saying it's propaganda are, you know,
misled.
Are misled and overreacting completely. Yeah. Because, you know, there are characters that say, you know, this is, we shouldn't be here. There's like an actual, like, you know, supporting character who is a soldier who's like, are we doing the right thing? You know, should we be here? There's that doubt in the story. Is it as well done as it should be to really be a true anti-war film? No, it probably could be a little better. Speaking of the nominations, I think it doesn't deserve to be nominated for best screenplay. It was, because it's very unbalanced. There's times where there's something of an identity crisis going on where it's like, do you want to, you know, it's like you want, they want to support, show support for our armed forces, which is fine, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's also like, it almost gets in the way of kind of showing the very harsh realities of PTSD and all that. And it's more celebrating him as a soldier and not so much as the man after he comes back and he helps his fellow veterans,
which would say is arguably like the more interesting aspect of it.
Yeah, and it kind of shows when you look at the Wikipedia page, which I'm looking at right now, and it's, you know, some of the first information you see is with 255 kills, 160 of which are officially confirmed by the Department of Defense, Kyle is the deadliest marksman in the U.S. military history. And so the movie's kind of just throwing that out there first, which is a little unfortunate because it's like, that's not what made Chris Kyle, you know, love him or hate him. Like, you know, he actually gave back to his community beyond just, you know, serving his country.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, and he's protecting people. It's like, what was it? You, Steven, that we were talking about, where veterans, like, you were watching The Nightly Show, right?
Yes, I was.
Yeah, because Steven was telling me about this great episode of The Nightly Show with, what's his name?
Larry Wilmore.
Larry Wilmore. Yeah, Larry Wilmore, which took over for the Colbert Report, and they had, it's a really cool show. It's a, like, a panel show similar to Real Time with Bill Maher, and they did a thing about American Sniper where they brought in, you can tell more about it, Steven, but, you know, they brought in veterans and they brought in other people.
Yeah, like, one of the guests was another sniper, and I think it was a guy that actually knew, was it Chris Kyle, you said?
Yeah, Chris Kyle.
I think he knew Chris Kyle. He was a I don't want to say rival sniper, but I mean, I think he had, like, comparable, like, merits.
Yeah.
There was another veteran, that's gone to Iraq and Afghanistan a number of times. There was a Rolling Stone writer and then like a comedian, I guess, to just kind of lighten the tone sometimes.
Yeah. How about airline food? Waka waka.
Well, how about sandwiches?
They would talk about the PTSD aspect of it. It's like, oh yeah, that's real. I mean, there was a good couple of years where I was drinking from like 6 a.m. to like 4 a.m. And, you know, like the comedian was like, anybody that's drinking at like 6 in the morning, I'm going to hang out with you. So,
yeah.
But yeah, they did talk about it a bit. I think the writer for Rolling Stone was upset that they didn't have that whole perspective of, oh, we invaded the wrong country thing. And it's like, that's not the story they wanted to tell.
Well, and it's also like,
dude, it's Rolling Stone.
Well, yeah, and really Stone. my rebuttal to that is be like, why do you need to be told that?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like if you feel that way, then, you know, fine. I mean, and just, you can apply it to the movie, I guess.
I would bring up The Hurt Locker, which never once tries to sell like an agenda on like whether the war was right or wrong. It just is.
Yeah.
And The Hurt Locker, look at the accolades that it got. I think it's an excellent film.
And I think this movie tries to do that sometimes.
But it's also kind of irresponsibly written.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not as well written.
Well, and it has some things going against it because it's talking about a real life person.
Yeah.
You know, and The Hurt Locker, I don't think is based on any.
No, The Hurt Locker is very fictional.
Yeah, so The Hurt Locker can very much just focus on ideas.
Yeah.
And exploring, exactly. Like, basically be a character piece, And yeah. this is more like, you know, it's a biography.
What was it about the panel that you wanted me to elaborate on?
I don't remember.
Well, like, there was the sniper, he said, like, oh, yeah, when you come home from war, people always ask you, like, how many people did you kill? How many people did you kill? But nobody asks you, like, how many people did you save?
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting kind of perspective that I think gets talked about in the American Sniper, right? Or
a little bit. It's hinted at. There's not a scene where that happens to Chris Kyle, per se. But he is very much, like, he very much is, in the movie, he's very, like, humble. He's just like, I'm just doing my job, you know. And there's a scene that's, you know, a little corny, but it's where a soldier meets with Kyle. Like, they're just at, like, a garage getting their car fixed. And Chris Kyle's with his son. And this guy walks up to them, and he's like, it's like, you're Chris Kyle, or he says whatever. And he's like, kneels down to the kid and says, your dad saved my life and stuff, and shows, like, you know, that he has a prosthetic leg and stuff like that. And it's a fine enough, it's a perfectly harmless, fine scene.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of stuff, but, you know, it's a movie that is very much, it's a solid movie. It doesn't deserve to be praised as this amazing, great movie. I still prefer stuff like The Hurt Locker to it. I think ultimately it's just unbalanced. It has too many fake babies. Because I want to talk about them fake babies.
That you can't eat.
That's a segue that always works. Fake babies.
You can't eat sandwiches.
So yeah, it's kind of famous now. It's pretty infamous now about American Sniper's fake babies, which it bewilders me about these fake babies. Steven, you clarified it for me. You or Neil. But, like, one of the babies was, like, sick, and the other one...
One of them came to the set, like, with the flu or something. And
fucking
one
parents.
Of them, like, just couldn't make it or something like that. Yeah.
Just got holed up in traffic.
Yeah. Got stuck on, like, the, you know, Route 66 freeway. You know?
And the baby's on the phone, and he's yelling at, like, the producer. He's like, I drive a Dodge Stratus.
People are like, you know, why are you driving? You're a baby. You can't drive. And he's like, you can't tell me what I can't do. Quit being ableist.
I'm a man. The baby's I drive already a Dodge an Stratus.
Because the baby's already an asshole.
What were we joking about earlier? Like,
it's like, I demand fresh breast milk in my trailer. Something like that. And we were like, imagine,
get
like,
your head out of your ass.
God, I'm an artiste.
He's like Puff Daddy in that Chappelle Show skit. He requires breast milk from a Serbian immigrant.
Yes.
Milk.
It's funny because there is a scene.
My day, yay.
there is a scene with a real baby, you know, because Chris Kyle has two kids. He has a son and a daughter, and then the daughter's born. There's a scene, and I'm pretty sure it's like a dream or something, but like he has like a PTSD kind of thing where he goes to look at his baby through the glass, you know, and his baby's crying, and like the crying stresses him out, and he wants his baby to be fine, and the nurses aren't really attending to the baby. You know, they're attending with other babies at the moment, but he's like pounding on the glass and he's like, help my baby, blah, 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 you know, and
it makes that sound. It's great. Blah, 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 blah.
I'm a paraphrasing, of course, but, it's a real baby. And then you cut to a scene later, which is a very, like, pretty emotional scene where, you know, he's very much off in his own place, you know, just pretty much having his war flashbacks and dealing with PTSD, and his wife's just kind of sitting there, you know, nursing the baby, and is just like, what is wrong with you? Who are you? Like, not, she doesn't say, who are you? I don't think, but I hope not, but
God, I hope not.
Then they have the fucking baby, and she's like, you know, holding, poor Sienna Miller had to hold this fucking fake baby up to her nips, and just like, and the thing does like this, like, hand grab that's so like jerky.
Yeah.
And creepy looking. Like, it's very, like, you'd think it's like a fucking Chucky doll or some shit.
Yeah.
You know? Like a, what was it? What was the doll in Child's Play?
Chucky.
No, like the brand.
It's a good guy doll.
Yeah, right? Good guy doll. It's very much like they just like ripped the hair off of a good guy doll, put it in like girl baby clothes and fucking put it in her arms. It's so creepy. And it sucks because it does take you out of the movie, especially if you know that it's there. If you know going into the movie that there's a fake baby, two fake baby scenes.
You had me at one, but two?
you had my curiosity
at one fake baby, but at two,
you have my attention. So, I don't know. I mean, I hope you guys, you know, do go and watch American Sniper.
I was going to say, before we wrap that up, I was going to say that you and I were talking about this earlier, and I was talking about how Clint Eastwood pretty famously does not rewrite the scripts to the movies that he shoots anymore. Like, I think he stopped after Changeling. Like, it was either Letters from Iwo Jima or Changeling. Like, he stopped doing it. Like,
Letters from Iwo Jima is, like, his last great movie.
It really is. Oh, my God. It's so...
So maybe, like, that's the one.
Yeah. He doesn't rewrite the scripts anymore. Like, he doesn't treat them or doctor them or anything himself anymore. And it really shows with a lot of the stuff that he's done lately. Like, there's just... It feels like his heart's not into it. And that's really frustrating because Clint Eastwood used to be, like, such a fantastic director. And now I just kind of go see his stuff out of, like... respect, I guess, and then I'm just like, what? Hope.
Yeah, because I think the last good movie he made was Gran Torino.
Yeah, Gran Torino. I've only seen bits of Changeling, and I liked that one a bit.
Changeling is okay.
There are aspects that I like about that one, but then like J. Edgar actually like legitimately pissed me off.
Yeah. What about Invictus? Did you see Invictus?
I did see Invictus. That one was a $10 nap.
How about Hereafter?
Did
Invictus?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he did Invictus. Let's see, how many movies has he done in the last 3-4 years? He's done 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Wow.
Since Letters from Iwo Jima, his last great movie, he has directed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 movies. So that was 2006. So in 9 years, he's done, 7 movies?
Pretty spry for an old fellow.
Well, he's been doing...
He's spry for an old guy.
He's got a couple years since then where he directed 2 movies a year. Changeling and Gran Torino were in 1 year. Yeah. You know, and Jersey Boys and American Sniper, it's technically the same year. I know American Sniper didn't get wide until January, but...
But it was made around the same time.
Yeah.
Jersey Boys, that was a disappointment.
I don't know. I wish he would go back to like some kind of like true crime kind of stuff. Like,
that'd be awesome. And like, he should rewrite the script.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's like, I want him to do something like Mystic River or something again, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Because Mystic River is fantastic.
But I was saying, like, I feel like American Sniper definitely suffers from not being rewritten by Clint Eastwood. Like, he chose a really bad time to stop doing that.
Yeah, well, the guy is 84, so...
It's true. But, I mean, like, even then, if he can put the effort into writing it, or into directing it... but then again, I'm not him, so I cannot say one way or the other. But anyways, like, you and I were talking about that, and, you know, I feel like American Sniper is probably definitely a victim of that. Yeah. And we were thinking about, like, all the different ways that you could, like, punch that script up.
Oh, yes, yeah. We were talking about how... One idea I had, and I talked about this off mic with Casey over Facebook, being he is a writer, so, and I just kind of threw out, like, what if they did, they had framing devices. Instead of doing it linearly, they had a framing device where Chris Kyle is in, like, a therapy with his former veterans, because there's kind of an interesting thing that they kind of go into, but not enough. Where you have him, all of his scars are very much mental, and you've got all these veterans that he helps out that very much have physical scars. You know, they're amputees, missing fingers, all kinds of stuff. And that's where I think the movie stumbles, in that it focuses so much on his war career, which, yes, it's impressive. And yes, I do kind of like to see it that he's just do. They paint it more as he's just trying to protect people. He's not doing it in the movie to, you know, hunt Muslims and kill the quote unquote savages and all that garbage. But you know, when you can definitely tell that there's like there's good here. This man did good, if anything, in that he helped.
He's not necessarily a do-gooder, but he has done good.
Exactly.
Thanks, Inherit Vice.
Yeah, and I wish they did more of that. Like I told Neil, it's probably like the last 20 minutes that they really get into that, where he finally accepts going to the Veterans Association, and it's just kind of a big sad thing where it's like, oh man, there's so much here that they could be doing to really develop him as a character and show his healing process, and then. Instead, we just kind of
don't do it.
They just don't do it. They just kind of have, like, you know, a couple scenes where he takes people to the shooting range and blah, 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 blah. And then they're sitting around in folding chairs, blah, blah, blah. And then we have the last scene where all of us know that Chris Kyle dies. Spoilers, I guess.
What?
Yeah, I know. Casey apparently didn't know when he saw it. So if Casey was here, he'd be like, whoa, spoilers.
Next, you're going to tell me that Titanic actually happened.
Well, he did yell spoilers when Steven talked about the ending of Foxcatcher.
Because it's based on actual events about a coach that killed, like, one of his players. Like,
my mom remembers that story.
Yeah, my dad remembers that story.
My dad remembers that story. And I'm still here.
I don't remember anything.
I don't. I wish I had gum.
If I didn't know any better, I'd say that the Foxcatcher incident happened maybe when our parents were around our age or something.
I don't know about that, but it was in the 90s.
Do you think they make gum sandwiches?
No, that sounds awful.
wait, when did the Foxcatcher thing happen?
I think it was in the 90s.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, no. I mean, well,
I was too young to care about such things.
Let's see, when was it?
Too busy ingesting Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle comics.
Clearly my priorities were in the right place. Okay,
yeah, so. Exactly.
Like, I'm trying to see, what's the name of Mark Ruffalo's Dave Schultz? Let's look at, yeah, he died in 1996.
Mm.
So that's when it ends. You know, it covers a decent amount of time.
Yeah.
But that's where it ends. So
yeah, it's a great movie. Go see
spoiler
it.
Alert!
Yeah. Spoiler alert!
Spoiler alert! You're a bitch.
This movie based on an actual event happened
about murder.
But what? Yeah, Chris Kyle, that, you know, he dies. You know, and again, the scene that leads up to his death, I was telling Neil, is kind of amazingly telegraphed and like very much. It's like. It's like he knows he's gonna die, or he's just like the making the movie, like the writer, whoever wrote the screenplay. It's like he just took like, oh yeah, he's gonna die, so let's just have, you know, him kind of make his rounds and have a little moment with all of his wife and his kids, and he's just like kind of goes off into the sunset, and it pans over, and you see the guy that he's gonna go help. And then it's like, they show him, and he looks like a fucking, like, you can tell that, like, this guy ain't right. That boy ain't right. Like, I described it to Neil, like, he's like a snidely Whiplash villain, where it's just like, I think there might even be a musical sting where it pans over to him, but, you know, it's very much like, well, I'm just gonna go off to help this, you know, just the son of this woman that came to me, and it's going to be okay. I'll be back. You know, it's like all this shit where you're like, he ain't fucking coming back. It's like the equivalent of like, I just got engaged.
I made a huge mistake.
What's that scene from the Valentine's Day episode of The Simpsons where it's on the, in Vietnam with, Skinner, is it right?
Oh yeah,
where he's like, I got a Valentine from my doll, and he gets like mowed down.
Johnny,
yeah, with the fucking like candy hearts.
I broke him. I broke,
I broke his brain.
I broke his. That's it.
Yeah, it feels very much like, oh man, you can totally fucking tell that Chris Kyle's gonna die. It's very both frustrating and funny.
I don't know. How does it rank compared to the last scene in Lincoln? the Spielberg film.
Oh, Lincoln. Well, Lincoln has like 8 blast scenes. So yeah.
Well, Mary, I like that movie, but
I like Lincoln too. It's just that goddamn that ending has so many endings. It has more endings than fucking Return of the King. I swear to God.
Yeah,
it's
like, and none of them really work.
It could have just fucking ended perfectly with them riding to the fucking
with them walking down the hallway. I expected it to just end there, and I'm like, you know, it's a little like whatever, but that's fine.
Or you could
and
have
then
had
every scene afterwards is like, please tell me they're not ending it here. Why is this here? Like, interrupting the scene at the end at the children's theater with the president's been shot. Like, oh, so this is how we decided to do this. Okay, sure. But then, like, you know, them trying to remove Lincoln's son from the box or whatever, and he's like holding onto the rail, screaming no, which is like, this is just fucking embarrassing.
Why?
And then it ends with like, you know, oh, he belongs to the ages now. Like, please don't show that. That's without context and it's stupid. Don't do that. And then it ends with like a candle with the reflection of like him delivering a speech. What is it? Like the Emancipation Proclamation or whatever. It's like, why is this here? Why are you showing this? This is a terrible ending. And then they fucking end it.
Yeah.
All the worst ways.
Yeah,
I like Lincoln, but that was fucking irresponsible. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and then
I'll never forgive it.
Like, I mean, American Sniper might as well have ended like right before the credits, like, and then he died. You know, I mean, it basically does where it does have a crawl where it's like, yeah, I mean, I mean, it does end with the text that he did. You know, he was murdered by. I forget the guy's name that he took
he was
out.
Murdered by Snidely Q Whiplash, as seen in this screenshot
here.
And then just bring that up.
That doesn't look like the actual man that killed him. And then there's you know archive footage.
It was our caterer.
There's archive footage of his funeral and how they drove his coffin around I guess the state of Texas and people had flags and all that stuff, all that good stuff. So.
A la Lincoln.
Oh, Lincoln.
What? Like, is that a link? What is happening here?
But yeah, American Sniper. It's uneven is one word you could use it. I think the war scenes are fine. I know I was telling Neil that I was frustrated with the fact that it feels like every time they introduce Muslims that Muslim citizens that could be just innocent people, and there are they're not all just like fucking fucking Team America shit going on or anything.
Durka Muhammad Jihad.
Exactly.
Thank God.
Sherpa.
There's obviously there's like bad guys and there's a fucking rival sniper. Yeah.
Carlos the Jackal.
Oh my God, no. But you're anyway, welcome.
Cobra Kai sniper.
And there's even a scene I was telling Neil that it frustrated me where, he's basically taking shelter in the house of a Muslim family, an Iraqi family, and they're having dinner and they're talking, and then I'm like, okay, just have these people be on the up and up, man, please. Just have this family be good. And then of course, Chris Cal gets paranoid. It's actually kind of a clever little way he finds out is that, the father reaches for something and his elbow is like really, really like chapped and roughed up. Like he's been resting it.
Yeah.
Like you would with a gun. Yeah. And so he's like, and then he's got to investigate the house and he finds a huge stash of weapons. And I'm like, God damn it.
He's like, Chris Kyle senses activate.
Yeah, it's just like, God, just once. Just have, and again, to the point of Chris Kyle, it's not like he's some like remorseless killer. He's not celebrating the death of every person he killed. He's not like, bam, yeah, like fist pump. No, he's just doing his job.
I was just picturing him playing Cool in the Gang Celebration every time he kills.
Oh my God, it's so fucking awful. Fucking 360 no scope.
Achievement unlocked.
I know, it's like fucking Oscar Call nominations. Of Duty bullshit. But it's like there are scenes like, you know, the scene from the trailer where you see the mother and the child approaching the convoy. I wish more scenes were like that emotionally.
Mm. That was weird. Like when I saw the trailer, I was like, oh my God, this is the most tense thing I've ever seen from a Clint Eastwood movie.
And, you know, you can tell that he's like very shooken up by having to shoot these two people. And it's not just like, oh man, I gotta kill these people because because they're fucking, you know, Allah worshiping fucking savages, you know. It's like, as people fucking think that this movie says, people
it's not
think
like
that
he shoots them and he's like spits on the ground and says like smelly brown people. I don't know.
Jesus fucking Christ.
That's according to salon.com.
Yeah, basically.
I have it right up here.
No,
let's keep coming up with crazy ways he could possibly celebrate.
And you know what? This could all very well be in the fucking biography.
I don't know.
I don't know, but who knows?
The book.
All the day.
God damn it.
It's funny enough that you mention it. The first edition of the book actually came with a CD. With one song, and it was actually Casey and the Sunshine Band's Give It Up, and you're supposed to play that anytime he details a kill. So, like, anytime it happens, you put that on, and you hear, na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, baby, give it up, baby, give it up. And, you know, you're supposed to celebrate, because he killed a smelly brown person. So there
you know,
go.
If there's a hell, we're fucking going to it.
Yeah, probably.
Probably. We booked our tickets a while ago, though. Anyway.
So college.
We're not already there?
We're not already there, I guess. Anyway.
Judging by the weather outside, clearly
well,
not.
And I spoiled a little scene for Neil where there's a later scene where he's, you know, pretty much on his perch looking around. And he takes out a guy who's about to fire an RPG near some of his, near some of Kyle's, you know, fellow soldiers. He takes him out, so the guy dies and leaves his RPG there, and then there's a kid, and the kid walks up and he picks up the RPG, and you know Chris is just like, "Fuck, don't do anything, don't do anything," and like he's on the verge of tears, basically just begging to this kid, you know, but he can only hear, "Put it down, put the fucking RPG down," and then the kid does, and the kid runs away, and it's just like this huge, it's almost as tense as that first sequence,
yeah,
where you're just like, "Oh please," and I'm kind of proud of the movie, you know. To have that where it's just like the kid drops it and goes.
Yeah.
And it's like, yes.
So basically like the long and short of it comes down to the movie's not necessarily worthy of the praise, but it's also not worthy of the criticism either.
Not really. I mean, yeah. unless they're criticisms of like the imbalance of the imbalance of the script, how it has identity issues. It doesn't know. Cause Clint Eastwood came out and said that he sees it as an anti-war film.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that he did, but I don't know if he totally succeeded in making one.
Yeah.
Necessarily.
It's a bit misguided, I guess.
It's a bit misguided. It's I feel like the intentions are very good, you know, and that it's like it's trying to, you know, shine a light. It's trying to shine a light on PTSD.
Yeah.
If anything.
But then it doesn't really do that much with the PTSD. It doesn't do as much with the PTSD as it could have.
Not as much as it could have. There is some stuff they do with it, but in terms of Chris Kyle actually healing and helping other veterans, that's a little bit glazed over. So
yeah.
Yeah.
So if we want to close that out, it actually has just been announced that the man who killed Chris Kyle, Eddie Routh, has been sentenced to life without parole.
There you go.
It was like, it was just announced.
Oh, yeah. Up to date. Geeks at college, not at college. Alumni. Tweet
us. Bringing you the news since Neil scoured the internet while talking about things.
Since Neil got bored and looked at his phone.
Blah, blah, blah. Bradley Cooper, blah, blah. Brown people, blah, blah. You know, God. Sandwiches, blah, blah.
Anyway, yeah, I'd give it a 6.5 or a 7 out of 10. It's
okay.
Nothing super enthusiastic, but it's worth watching. It's a competently made film. It's a is it below Clint Eastwood's standards? Yes, it's his best movie in a while, but still not as good as his best last, you know, really good movies.
It's no Unforgiven.
It's not, well, obviously, but I'm saying stuff like, you know, Million Dollar Baby, more recent stuff even.
Yeah.
It's not quite there yet. You know, I don't know what his next project's going to be or if he's going to make another movie. I hope, it's like I said, I hope he does another true crime. Well, not true crime, but like, because Mystic River's not true crime. It's based on a book, but some kind of crime thing, you know, something like that. Something great like that.
Something smaller scale.
Yeah. Something that can just be very, something that can be seen very objectively.
Yeah.
Which would be very nice.
Oh, Lord.
You know, if he can just, you know, nothing super controversial, but something that's very good and affects you emotionally, you know, that'd be really nice. You know, Million Dollar Baby.
Clint Eastwood's puppies dressed as cats.
Well, because, and that's the thing is that with Clint Eastwood, you know that he's not like a super pro-war guy. The guy made fucking Letters from Iwo Jima.
Yeah, which
is all about, you know, really humanizing the Japanese, you know, soldiers of World War II, something that doesn't happen very often at all.
Yeah, exactly.
In, you know, American cinema.
Yeah.
Even though it's largely in Japanese, but, you know,
It's such a fucking great movie, though.
It is. It is very much. But anyway, that's enough about American Sniper. It's solid, I think. If anything, check it out yourself. If you don't want to pay it, go see it in a theater, then, you know, rent it or get it from Redbox or anything. But that's it for that segment, and I guess we'll move on to the final bit, since it's very recent news. We're just going to go right through the Oscar wins, if you guys don't mind.
Totally fine, Oscars.
So we will wrap this episode up, just going through them. Neil can give little, since he wasn't here when we talked about the Oscars last episode, or two episodes ago. Anyway, so let's start with, what should we start with? I guess we can start with Best Animated Feature and how we're all like, I guess at one.
Yeah. As someone who's not seen Big Hero 6, I cannot say one way or the other. I actually didn't see any of them. Because the person that I would have seen How to Train Your Dragon 2 with moved. She had the audacity to move and go on with her life, which, whatever. She was gonna. We were gonna go see it together, and she moved. So I just never got around to seeing it. I once again never got around to seeing Big Hero 6 because it's kind of a struggle to get me to go to the theaters nowadays.
Yeah, the only one I've seen is How to Train Your Dragon 2.
Yeah.
I remember talking to Steven about it, and I can't say I'm surprised, because
no, of course not.
You know, it just feels, especially knowing more or less how they admitted that they don't see all the nominees.
Yeah,
with Frozen winning, and Frozen winning against some of the stuff it was nominated against, I think is really a pretty big crime. And I think it kind of happened again. And not to say that Big Hero 6 isn't a bad movie. You know, or
I hear it's perfectly. You know, I hear it's really, it's quite good.
It's enjoyable. I'm just saying,
it's not the Lego Movie.
It's, well,
let's even, just say what it is.
Not even counting the Lego Movie because it's not nominated, but it's like, I'd probably put How to Train Your Dragon 2 above it. Yeah. Tale of Princess Kaguya is fucking gorgeous.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen any of that. Song of the Sea, which is from the people that did The Secret of Kells.
Yeah.
I've seen
like a trailer, and I thought it was like, wow, this is great.
Yeah, and the Box Trolls, just because it's fucking Leica.
I like the Box Trolls.
Did you see it?
Yeah.
Oh, see, so you've seen one.
I actually completely forgot that the Box Trolls was nominated. I'm just gonna be upfront about that.
Well, and
it was good though. It was good.
It was good. Yeah. And should the Lego Movie have been nominated? I mean, on the Oscar show, I basically said, hey, throw out Big Hero 6, put in the Lego Movie, you're done.
Yeah, exactly. And it probably would have won. Big Hero 6 wins.
Yeah. But it just feels like, yeah, it's Disney. Yeah, we're still rolling. Frozen's still the biggest fucking thing ever. So I feel like that definitely.
Disney basically just gets Best Animated Feature, you know, awards like a fucking Pez dispenser.
Not really, though. This is only its second win.
Really?
Yeah. It had never won before Frozen. It's always been Pixar or DreamWorks or Ghibli or
that's weird.
Aardman. Well, because Disney sucked when they first introduced the best animated feature award, you know?
That's very true.
You know, I mean, what are they going to fucking nominate? Chicken Little? Fuck that movie.
Yeah, Chicken Little.
But anyway, yeah. Disappointed about best animated feature film.
Yeah.
Best adapted screenplay went to The Imitation Game.
Which is...
Have you seen that movie?
No, okay. I have not. But based on what I've heard, the script is, like, absolutely, like, the weakest part of the film.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's, yeah. And, of course, then you think about all the other things that were adapted that could have been nominated, mainly Gone Girl.
Mm, yeah.
Gone Girl, I think, is the biggest.
Well, I would have taken out, again, I mentioned American Sniper, take that out.
Yeah.
Take that out and you put in Gone Girl. There you go.
Well, it's like Gone Girl, one, if you want to talk about, you know, the whole diversity thing, that's a woman. She adapted her own script.
She would have been the only woman, as far as I can see.
And that would have been an amazing, you know, it was an amazing adaptation of the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Gillian Flynn actually knew exactly what to cut. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there you go. You get the diversity quota and you get a good screenplay. You knock out two birds with one script. There you go. But they didn't. And sadly, the thing with the Oscars that I think a lot of people forgot is that a lot of great movies always get fucking snubbed.
Oh, like, yeah.
They always get shortchanged.
I mean,
they always get shortchanged. I don't necessarily think it's like outright racism or sexism or anything. It's out of touch. It's tone deaf. But I wouldn't immediately attribute it to either one of those two.
Well, what you could also say is that those two things are a factor of it, of just being kind of out of date.
Yeah.
You know, that it's not just racism and sexism and, you know, homophobia or whatever, you know, but those are a part of it, of a bigger problem of just being out of date and out of touch.
Yeah. There's that saying that I've been trying to live by pretty decently, like for a little bit now, which is, you know, never attribute to malice what could easily be attributed to stupidity. And to that, I would attribute it to stupidity and not necessarily malice.
Yeah.
It definitely reeks of cluelessness, but not necessarily like outright evil,
mm-hmm.
like everyone on the internet seems to be saying. But you know, like that's the thing. Like, there are always great movies that just get completely like left out.
But I mean, you know, we talk about that subject matter about, you know, representation and awarding.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, like Oyelowo not being nominated, Ava DuVernay not being nominated, Bradford Young having two opportunities to be nominated for cinematography this year, mm-hmm. not getting nominated.
Well, yeah, Selma, it's like everyone complains about the Lego movie, but Selma's really, to me, probably the biggest snub.
Probably one of the more baffling ones, just because, like, you know, it had all of those, it won all of those awards ceremonies beforehand, and then the Oscars is just like, two.
Well, and I even mentioned to Steven, it almost comes off as like white guilt or something that it's even nominated for Best Picture, because it's like, if you're a Best Picture nominee, you have another nomination somewhere else, typically besides Best Original Song, you know.
I didn't watch the awards ceremony because I don't know, I was too busy watching everyone play Five Nights at Freddy's, but. I don't know, like, I heard the song, and I was not impressed, and I'm really hoping that the live version of it was better, because, you know, hell, it made people in the theater fucking cry. Yeah. So, you know, I hope it was better, because, like, the one recorded version that I heard, I was just like, this got nominated? Really? Okay, whatever.
Well, you know. Anyway, moving on.
Maybe I'm just an uncaring asshole, I don't know.
Well, obviously.
Oh, shut up.
Best original screenplay. Speaking of, well, at least in the screenplay, you got representation, because Graham Moore is, Right, yeah, Graham Moore, right, is the screenwriter of The Imitation Game, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's gay?
No, he is not gay.
He's not? Okay.
He's not gay.
I wasn't sure if he was.
He's getting torn apart because he dared to say something about, you know, being, you know, like, being true to yourself and being weird and don't commit suicide, and he's not gay.
Well, okay. Well, fuck those people. Anyway.
No, I shit you not. That is actually happening.
I'm not surprised. I mean, but hey, you know.
There were no less than 5 hashtags created for this.
Oh my god,
Oscar ceremony.
But anyway, speaking of actual representation, you know,
yes.
Alejandro G. Iñárritu.
Yes.
Yes, winning for best original screenplay for Birdman or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance.
Yes.
Which it cracks me up how they always put the full title
It's well, like, it's like, remember when Push, Precious was nominated?
They had the novel Push by
entire title.
Jesus Christ.
My film professor, when that was coming out, had to say the entire title. I don't know why he felt like he needed to, but he did, and it was very strange. Lovely, wonderful man, great teacher. That always confused me.
But you have, you know, Iñárritu, who, he's from Mexico, right?
He is indeed.
Yes.
You know who also was Mexican was...
Last year's winner.
Yes.
Oh, twofer.
Alfonso Cuarón was also Mexican. So two Mexican directors have won the past 2 years.
We're on a fucking roll.
That's pretty awesome.
That
so,
is pretty awesome.
I don't know. I guess you could you give some, you take some.
Yeah, so there you go. And, you know, he's up against stiff competition. You got... Well, granted, I don't know how much of a fucking screenplay Boyhood had, but... it's like knowing Linklater's process. It's like you got shit like, you know, fucking, like Before Midnight, which is very much improvised.
Yeah, and I think it's just like a rough outline.
I think Behind Midnight's fucking fantastic. Mm-hmm. But it's like when I saw it was nominated for best screenplay, it's like, why?
Yeah.
it's like just nominated for acting or something.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
But and Boyhood feels like the same fucking thing. And do you support Foxcatcher getting nominated?
Yeah, Foxcatcher's a great script.
All right, cool. How about Grand Budapest Hotel?
Yeah, and that one's delightful as well.
Yeah,
I do love Grand Budapest Hotel. Like on the surface, it's a very fluffy, light movie. But it actually does go into like a lot of heavy themes of nostalgia and wistfulness for the past, remembering the past, but kind of at a detrimental level, and just heartache, all that stuff, and it's got a lot of great themes about that, and of course that is like one of the most deceptively light movies because that ending, those last 15 minutes, just like fucking punch you in the stomach.
All right, and then did you see Nightcrawler?
Yes, I did. That one is also good for being nominated.
All right. Okay.
For screenplay. Actually, I think the script and Jake Gyllenhaal are the best things about it.
Yeah. At least one thing got nominated, right?
At least one thing got nominated. That's another thing. Jake Gyllenhaal getting snubbed. The fuck?
Yeah. Well, I will say, best actor is a very stiff...
It really is.
Benedict Cumberbatch, Michael Keaton. Again, I think Bradley Cooper deserves to be nominated. There's just... Yeah. It's almost like they just need to expand that fucking category. How come they expand Best Picture, but not
anything else? Well, the thing with Best Picture, expanding Best Picture is, and that's really frustrating because it doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah, not necessarily.
Really doesn't. Up to 10 movies can be nominated, and they just kind of waste those nominations with a lot of movies that are like, really, did you need to nominate that? Did you just need to hit a quota or something?
You mean like how they apparently treated Selma? Because it's like, again, why did you nominate Selma when you didn't nominate for anything else?
Yeah.
So are you just kind of like, oh, shit, my white guilt. Here you go.
Yeah.
You know, because exactly. It just feels very pandering to put Selma in there, even though it deserved, I'm sure it deserved, at least some acting recognition, too.
Well, David Oyelowo not getting nominated is some bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Did you see Selma?
No.
Okay.
I've heard enough of Selma is one of those like 12 Years a Slave last year, which people seem to forget that 12 Years a Slave got nominated for like a shit ton of stuff and also won a shit ton of stuff.
Yeah.
So people even admitted like I hadn't even seen 12 Years a Slave and I still voted for it.
Yeah.
And then like this year it's like, it's like, I don't know. Remember last year, guys?
Yeah. It just seems really backwards. Like you thought that there was like nice progress with 12 Years a Slave. And then it's like, oh, never mind.
Every year is different,
I guess. Every year is different, I guess.
Who knows? 12 Years a Slave could actually be the better film. I don't know.
Probably. Who knows?
12 Years a Slave is an excellent movie and totally deserves it.
It very much is.
Selma's one of those where like I have to like sort of build myself up to see it because I know that it's going to be real heavy.
Oh, yeah. And, well, I mean,
given a lot of stuff that's happened this year with my family, like I don't know if real heavy is exactly what I need right now.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on, best supporting actress went to Patricia Arquette.
Yes.
Fighting for womanhood everywhere. Hell yeah.
She's also getting shit for her speech.
Why?
Because it didn't reference intersectionality and trans women and blah, blah.
Where do you see this?
The internet.
Where?
Don't ask.
I am asking.
You just travel around enough. Ugh. Yeah, I know. Like
Neil
I said,
gets like around like a record.
It's almost like social outrage is getting, like, I mean, I've said this for like last year or so, but it is getting like to this ridiculous level of like kind of self parody.
Yeah.
Where it's like it's doing far more harm than good.
Just be happy that there's a woman campaigning for, you know, equal wages. And, you know, Jennifer Lopez and Meryl Streep are totally for it. You know, just be fucking happy that there's steps being made. Come on, man. It's like,
no, and, Taylor, that's not enough.
Anyway, Patricia Arquette won. Laura Dern was also nominated. Keira Knightley.
She was.
What do you think? Were you okay with Emma Stone being nominated?
For Birdman?
Yes.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Okay.
She's awesome in Birdman, so there you go.
Yeah.
Everyone's awesome in Birdman. Birdman is awesome.
Fucking dies in Amazing Spider-Man 2, gets an Oscar nomination in Birdman.
Yeah.
Technically, like, two superhero kind of related movies.
Yeah, I know, right? God, that's great.
Anyway, and I guess the obligatory Meryl Streep nomination for Into the Fucking Woods.
Of course.
Anyway.
Meryl Streep's at the Oscars? What a surprise.
Meryl Streep is not... Meryl Streep for... coming to the Oscars this year as Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep's shoes. Look at them. They're gorgeous, just like Meryl Streep.
Anyway, moving on. Best Supporting Actor. Did you see Whiplash?
No. I've been trying to get everyone to go see Whiplash.
All right.
And no one would see it with me.
Go ahead.
All of these technical awards, and all of a sudden people are like, yeah, maybe I'll go see it. I'm like, fuck all y'all. Let me look it up right now.
It's got Amazon. Fucking J. Jonah Jameson yelling at young Reed Richards. Come on.
It has the line, "What are you, some single tear motherfucker?" in there when the kid starts crying. It's like, that's, oh, how do you not love that?
So J.K. Simmons, J.K. Simmons. I love how J.K. Simmons is now Oscar winning J.K. Simmons.
Long time coming,
man. Those fucking farmers. Farmers
Insurance. Hold on a sec. Ah, yes. Whiplash is available to rent on Amazon.
Ooh, nice.
And, $6 for HD, $5 for SD. Oh, other my God.
Nominees. Robert Duvall for The Judge. Ethan Hawke for Boyhood. Edward Norton for Birdman.
Yes, he was also very good. Did you see Birdman?
No, not yet.
Dude, you need to get on Birdman.
I just want to fucking see it. I just don't like going to every last like month of episodes. I've had to say, like, I don't like going to movies by myself.
If I were there, I'd go with you.
Well, fuck yeah, you would.
And then I'd fondle you. What?
And that would be great. But, you know, that's just not how it is right now. I mean,
yeah, I know.
It's going to be out. When does the Blu-ray come out? Like, in?
It's already out. I found it at Best Buy the other day.
See, maybe I'll go pick that up.
Go pick it up on Blu-ray. It's speaking of Blu-rays, cinematography.
Oh, do we want to talk about that?
Emmanuel Lubezki won this year for Birdman. He also won last year for Gravity.
Oh my God, that's the same guy?
Yes, that is the same guy.
He's just getting around like a fucking...
Not only is he Mexican, diversity, there you go, whoa. But he has also won twice in a row.
Jesus fucking Christ.
I know. And also, like, I have always thought that there has been never a more deserving cinematographer aside from Roger Deakins. Who is overdue for an Oscar that bad. And there he is. He wins it twice in a row.
Nice. Nice. Anyway, moving on.
It's great.
Mark Ruffalo?
He was excellent.
Okay. All this is going to be is just like, oh, yeah, he was good. Whatever.
Yeah, he's great. No, he's actually one of the best things about Foxcatcher.
Awesome. Like, Mark Ruffalo is one of those guys where it's like, he kind of started out in like romantic comedies and stuff, and now he's really like into... you know, real
stuff,
real heavy stuff. That's really cool. And Avengers, you know, and then he's also playing Bruce Banner.
Yeah, exactly. No, he's excellent in Foxcatcher. If you ever get the chance, like, definitely check out Foxcatcher. I feel like a lot of people trashed it because, you know, Bennett Miller got nominated for Best Director and Ava DuVernay didn't. So they're putting him down. Like, you know, why he get nominated? Blah. It's like, excuse me. Did you see Foxcatcher? It is a gorgeously directed
movie. It's like, why just pick, like, one movie to pick on, not just be like, hey, why don't you fill up another slot?
Yeah,
Then exactly. again, I'm like, Richard Linklater, brink.
I know.
12 years to make, guys.
It took 12 years to make.
What's the story? Well, it took 12 years to fucking make. What's your movie about? Well, it took 12 years to fucking make.
When did we turn into Red Letter Media?
Well, because it's so fucking true when you think about it.
It really is. Like,
I haven't even seen Boyhood, and I'm sure it's fine. Like, it's just that there's things about it that are really bugging me from what I'm seeing, is that they're so focused on this gimmick of this kid being, you know...
Yeah.
Of, oh man, he aged on screen. It's like, well, cool, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
But, like, what else can you give me?
Well, you know, it took 12 years to make.
Yeah, I know Casey wasn't a fan of it, so.
Yeah, that's what
And
I
he
heard.
Feels bad, and I'm like, tell him, like, don't fucking feel bad about it, you know, maybe.
Oh, this time he doesn't feel bad about disliking Hot Fuzz, but he feels bad about disliking
I think he kind of felt bad, like, he wanted to like Hot Fuzz, and it's just like, didn't like Hot Fuzz.
I think he finally likes it, like, okay now.
I guess, whatever.
Which is okay. Dude, I'll take it.
That's not enough.
Sometimes it's never going to be enough. You just learn to live with it.
It's never enough. It's never enough.
You know what there is also is never enough of?
Julianne Moore.
Sandwiches. But also Julianne Moore.
Anyway, best actress, Julianne Moore for Still Alice.
Never saw it.
Never saw it either. I heard it's eh.
I don't think that movie ever got, like, a wide release. I don't think it even really got much of a release. I actually don't think that movie exists.
Oh, that Alice. She's still Alice.
She's still Alice.
Yeah. The only one on here I can comment about is Rosamund Pike, and she totally deserved it. You were here when I unveiled my theory about how she got her Oscar-nominated acting talents.
Yes. Yes, I was.
Were you?
Yes.
How'd it go?
Dude, that was a while ago.
Oh, this was on a recent episode. How did I do it?
Oh, no, then I was not. I think we might have talked about it earlier then.
Well,
I was flashback, not on that
one. It's 2002. Die Another Day happens.
Shut up. Yeah, that sounds about right.
We have the end fight scene between Halle Berry, Oscar-winning Halle Berry, against Rosamund Pike. I like to believe that Rosamund Pike... like, absorbed Halle Berry's Oscar potential.
Yep.
Through the kicking of the knife into her chest by Halle Berry.
Yeah.
That's how it happens.
Amazingly, no one died by a knife to the chest in Gone Girl.
Yeah, surprisingly.
Surprisingly.
But she's fantastic. She makes that movie, I think. I think without her, that movie is a lesser film. It'd still be good, but...
Well, she is one part of a ton of amazing things about that movie.
But I feel I would say that her role is probably the most pivotal.
It really is. Well, I mean, like, you knew that Reese Witherspoon was originally supposed to play.
Yeah, she produced it.
Yeah, well, she ended up producing it because she had a meeting with David Fincher, and Fincher told her exactly what he thought of for Amy. And Reese Witherspoon apparently was so impressed that she said, "I don't fit that at all. But I like what you're doing, so I'm going to step back."
Yeah.
So, right off the bat, the power of David Fincher right there.
Right there.
But yeah, she ended up just producing it, which she was going to do anyways. So Rosamund Pike, I'd always been kind of championing her for a while. Saying, like, you know, she needs better stuff.
Yeah.
And to see her get chosen for Gone Girl is like, oh shit, that's going to be awesome and hopefully good for her. And she gets nominated, so like, I'm really happy for her.
There you go.
Yeah, my dream came true, and I'm sure hers did too.
Moving on to Best Actor, Eddie Redmayne of course wins. How do you feel about him winning?
I'm sure he did a great job. I like Eddie Redmayne. From what I understand, he did a great job portraying Stephen Hawking and the debilitations that come with ALS.
Apparently that was shot out of sequence, too.
I believe it, too.
Yeah, so not only that, he had to, you know, go from being, like, maybe one day shooting as, you know, more recent Stephen Hawking to the day after filming younger Stephen Hawking.
Yeah.
So it's not just him, like, having to basically just progressively get more, you know, in the role of being, you know, stricken by ALS, but, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it does definitely fit into that whole Oscar trope of, you know, you get an award for playing a disability. But I don't know. I have a weird relationship with a desire to see both the theory of everything as well as The Imitation Game. Because the theory of everything, like, on one hand, I love James Marsh as a filmmaker. I'm sure that, you know, the acting is very good. I hear the acting from the two leads is what carries the film. It's one of my favorite cinematographers shooting the film. It's gorgeous to look at from what I've seen. On the other hand, it's like, let's make a love story about Stephen Hawking. Like, what? There are definitely better things to do about that. Or
yeah,
to,
that's
to
always
do
been
about
something
Stephen Hawking.
That's something that's kind of been, like, turning me away from the movies. Just like, why are you focusing on that? Like, I guess I can get behind, like, okay, how it affected his marriage, his longtime marriage to his wife.
Yeah.
But at the same
even
time,
then,
it's
like one of the least interesting aspects of his life.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, you know, doing something about, I don't know, I'm trying to think of.
It's like doing something about Alan Turing and not including him being, like, gay.
Yeah, there you go. Or him, you know, solving the Enigma machine or whatever it's called.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just
the Enigma code.
The Enigma code and just focusing on, I don't know.
I mean, like, obviously you could balance both of them. They could both be thematically relevant, especially with a title called The Imitation Game.
Yeah.
Like him having, you know, like him being autistic. And then if I remember correctly, he was.
Alan Turing?
Yeah.
He might have been. I don't know.
Yeah,
I know
like,
he was.
I think he was on the spectrum. But like that, you know, and him being gay. And like, and all of those things could fit together, but it's like, no, he's not gay. Because like, that's such a pivotal thing in his life. That's like, that is sadly one of the things that he is remembered for, which you would really hope that he wouldn't be. And then, you know, just totally toss that out. And like, oh, you just put it in a slide there. It's like, that's just kind of irresponsible. I don't know.
Yeah.
But whatever. But with Theory of Everything, it's like the story kind of turns me off. Like, it's like, let's go with the least interesting aspect of Stephen Hawking and then make an entire movie about it. And also, that is one fucking aggressively awful title.
Yes.
That is such an awful title that it is like, I don't think I want to see it.
Yeah.
So,
I mean,
shame on them.
Doesn't
whatever.
He have, like, a biography or something?
Yeah, yeah. Even has an Errol Morris documentary about him.
I mean, why can't you do, like, A Brief History of Time or something like that? Like, use that.
Well, like, they have the Errol Morris documentary from the 80s that went unseen for like a long time. They only just recently released it on Criterion.
Yeah. Or you could do like The Grand Design or On the Shoulder of Giants, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. But no, love story, Stephen Hawking.
Theory of Everything.
Yeah. It's like, whatever. Imitation Game. I'm sure it's a fine movie. You know, I'm sure it's good.
You mean The Theory of Everything?
Either one. Either one. I hear The Imitation Game is good. I feel like it got dogged on a lot for this year at the Oscars because it's, you know, it gets nominated over other more deserving things.
The Imitation
Game? Which is kind
of
a shame. Yeah.
Why? The Imitation Game, like, won big at Toronto and stuff.
Well, I know that Casey said it was, like, one of his favorites of the year. So, like,
yeah.
I'm sure it's a fine movie, but it gets dogged on a lot.
Why? I don't get why.
Because the internet. I don't know. Like, you just see
again,
a lot of people, like,
again, so
all
it's
over.
Like, people, like, and trust me, I'm the one that's here campaigning for more representation of Selma and stuff, but it's,
yeah.
Like, why just specific movies? Why not just, you know, say, like, hey, they should be, you know, acknowledging these lesser seen actors, you know, these people of color, you know, these black actors, these Hispanic actors, Asian actors, writers, all these people that are non-white creators, you know. Why not just say that instead of just having to dog down something else that deserves to be there?
Because it's the way of the internet. I don't
but
know
it's
how
so
like I know it
dumb.
Sounds like such a I know and it's such a lazy cop-out thing for me to say because I say it a lot, but that's just how it is nowadays. It's like, "Oh, you're successful about something. Here, let's bring you down because, you know, you don't think exactly like us, you know, you don't agree with us or something. So, therefore you are bad."
And, okay, so I'm a little, like, about Redmayne being nominated because it just feels like the safe choice.
Yeah, it does. No, I think the exact same thing, but I'm sure he did a good job.
And I mentioned to Steven that,
is Steven, actually?
I don't know. He went to get more chicken sandwiches. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I feel like, not that a lot of other people could have played Hawking, but I feel like more, I mean, fucking Benedict Cumberbatch played fucking Stephen Hawking. At one
it's
point.
True, he did.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's while it's a great performance, I'm sure, it's something like Birdman. It's like no one else can be Birdman but Michael Keaton. just because of the subtext there.
Yeah.
You know, subtext, as I pointed out on Facebook. Did you see that?
Yes, I did. Yeah, yeah. It was funny.
You know, 25 years after he first debuted as Bruce Wayne / Batman in 1989's Batman, 25 years later, you have this, you know, send-up of, like, you know, / satire on basically Michael Keaton playing Michael Keaton, you know, as an actor who once played a superhero. No one else can really play that.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of like poor Michael Keaton. I remember mentioning the cases that it feels very much like Mickey Rourke with the wrestler.
And him losing out. That was so – I hated that so much.
But I feel like that's another thing. Like, you know, did Sean Penn play a good Harvey Milk? I'm sure.
It made Sean Penn likable, so there you go.
Well, yeah. And then he, like, ruins it again somehow.
Yeah, he usually finds ways.
Because it's Sean Penn. But,
yeah.
And then, you know, and I'm not saying, like, maybe, who knows, maybe someone else could have played Harvey Milk, but who knows who could have played the wrestler, you know? That's Mickey Rourke's role.
Mickey Rourke's personal experience brought so much to that role.
Exactly. You know, and I think that's what sets these
Same thing with Michael Keaton and Birdman.
Same thing with Michael Keaton and Birdman. There's such a big separation between the two roles because you have a role where it's like you're playing somebody, you're somebody trying to embody another person, you know, and that's great if you can do that. That takes a lot of skill. But then you have another role where you're not trying to be someone else. You're just basically putting your entire self into a role and something that's very personal and very close to who you are, you know?
And hoping it pays off.
And did you see the Vine where, like, Michael Keaton was totally ready and, like, he had a speech and he, like, slips it back into his suit jacket?
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
Oh, it's really sad.
Oh.
Fucking Michael Keaton. And Michael Keaton...
Apparently he gave, like, a really awesome, like, little speech when they were accepting Best Picture.
That's great.
So, yeah, like, he did get to say something, which is nice.
Well, my whole thing is, like, in recent years I've kind of really, you know, drummed up a lot of respect for Michael Keaton that should be, like, that I didn't have before that I should have had before. Because, I mean, people forget that he was fucking Beetlejuice, and he was fucking fantastic as Beetlejuice.
Well, he also has, like, really seriously great comedic timing and everything, and, like, you know, great dramatic weight, too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and then it's like Porco Rosso. He's fucking fantastic in Porco Rosso.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
And so it's... I wish I had known back when I was younger, so I would have given him less shit.
Exactly.
We were young and stupid. We can atone.
Anyway, and then... So, Steve Carell, You think Steve Carell should be in supporting actor, right?
He is a supporting.
Yeah. Yeah. And then put David Oyelowo in, in that slot. Or Jake Gyllenhaal, but, you know.
Or Jake Gyllenhaal. Either one, I can't really say.
And then, of course,
Little Michael, Quell Tumblr.
Would you have wanted Michael Keaton to win? Were you hoping that he won?
Yes.
Okay, just making sure.
Oh my god, yes, I was hoping he would win.
Okay, just making sure. Anywho, speaking of Birdman, best directing... Went to Birdman. Went to Alejandro G. Iñárritu. Iñárritu.
Yeah, exactly.
Alongside Wes Anderson in his first Best Director nomination. Right?
Yeah.
Hell yeah. And Bennett Miller in, like, the first nomination, like, the first time in a long time. Again, Richard Sherman. Why wasn't Foxcatcher nominated for Best Picture, but it was nominated for Best Director? That's like, I forget the last time that happened, but it's been a long time. It's around here somewhere. But anywho, I'll find it somewhere else. But it's been a while since a film was nominated for Best Director, but not Best Picture.
Yeah.
Especially when you have, you know, at least 5 nominees in Best Picture nowadays.
I have this crazy feeling it might have been Black Hawk Down.
Was Black Hawk Down Best Picture?
No, Black Hawk Down was nominated for Best Director.
It might have been something in between that and this.
Well, yeah, probably, but like the to my recollection, it was probably Black Hawk Down.
Okay.
Because that one, it's not a Best Picture movie, but the direction for it is so like insane.
Yeah.
That yeah, I understand the nomination. I'm actually very happy with the nomination, and of course, Ridley Scott did not win.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Ridley Scott when he loses an award?
No.
Dude is the grumpiest thing ever, and it's great. He is just
maybe he should start making better movies again.
Yeah, no.
Fingers crossed for The Martian, I guess.
I actually, yeah, I am crossing my fingers for The Martian. Here's to hoping.
So we're all like, are you, and Birdman would be your pick for best directing.
Steven or me?
Either.
Who are you asking?
Oh, it's Neil.
I would probably, yeah, that would probably be my bet. Like I said, I can't say anything about Selma. It sounds like Selma was told by, you know, basically the right person.
Yeah.
It sounds like it sort of embodies all the things that I liked about 12 Years a Slave, which is, you know, like there's no scenes of, you know, slow motion whips, you know, swelling music, you know, oh, I cried so hard when they whipped Queenie. You know, like it's just like an actually well-made film, you know, with actual substance and, you know, like a mature take on this, on the subject matter.
Okay.
You know, like rather than just having like all the scenes I cried my eyes out at, like it just has like this pervasive tone of like dread and oppression and whatnot.
So, but let me ask you this, of between Birdman, Grand Budapest Hotel and Foxcatcher, the three movies that you've seen,
yes.
Birdman would be your best director choice?
Yeah, probably just, like, the most audacious of the three. Like, okay. The other ones I knew what to expect. Birdman, I did not. Like, that was totally not what I was expecting in all the right ways. Yeah. Like, the one act, like, the one shot gimmick thing, like, it didn't even really feel like a gimmick. Like, it really did contribute to the whole theatrical feel of it.
Well, yeah. And Casey had a good point. I remember talking to him about it, too, is that unlike Boyhood, you know, with Birdman, which took 12 years to make.
Yeah.
Like our podcast a couple weeks ago, the podcast 12 years in the making. The gimmick of Birdman, you don't need to say it to summarize the movie, you know, to talk about Birdman. But Boyhood, yeah, I mean, you kind of have to talk about it. It's filmed over 12 years.
Yeah, exactly.
It's pretty unavoidable. So Birdman, you're not being like in one single take. You know.
Exactly. No, I agree wholeheartedly.
But, and Steven, you only saw Birdman of these, right? So.
Yeah, of the best picture, yeah, I only saw Birdman.
Or best director.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, good for Alejandro.
Mm-hmm.
Yay.
Finally.
Yeah.
No. Finally, Best Picture, which, of course, once again, goes to Birdman.
Yeah,
I just like how there's a Best Picture out there that's called Birdman.
Yeah, I know, right?
And then, like, I hope hundreds of years from now, aliens will come to Earth and they'll see that, like, oh, Birdman, based on the classic Hanna-Barbera serial.
Did you know that the guy who voiced Harvey Birdman just died?
No, that's Gary Cole. You're talking about Space Ghost.
Space Ghost, sorry.
Yeah. Wow, yes. Way to bring the room down, Neil.
I met him. He was really nice.
Yeah, Space Ghost.
Ugh. I told him about, like, you know, I love Space Ghost, and he was like, they're still airing that?
I grew up with Space Ghost. I grew up with a lot of, like, action Hanna-Barbera shit, including Birdman. So I was like, fucking Birdman? When this movie was announced, I'm like, that, okay. I wasn't sure what to expect, but...
Well, then, yeah, exactly.
Well! But, it's kind of funny. I remember hearing about Birdman, just to kind of, like, wrap it up. I remember hearing about a, movie called Birdman in, like, a year ago. Because we were looking up people for the draft, and I got Emma Stone, and it's like, what's this Birdman movie coming out? And there was stuff about filming Birdman, and you saw the Birdman costume. And it's like, you didn't know what to fucking think of this movie. Like, okay, there's some dude in a big suit. You know, I think... A lot of the more critical hype kind of came around because it was, you know, Alejandro G. Iñárritu doing it. And he had, you know, previous Oscar acclaim. So, but it was just such a weird thing. Like, what the fuck is this Birdman? Michael Keaton's in it, I guess. But and lo and behold, a year later, wins Best Picture. So,
I remember thinking the same thing. Like, I remember hearing the synopsis. Like, it's like a dark comedy called Birdman by the or it's a comedy called Birdman by Alejandro Gonzalez Iñárritu. And I was like, one of those things does not belong with the others. You know, this coming from the man who made 21 Grams, Babel. Morris Perros,
Babel. Beautiful.
A comedy.
Yep.
Like, well.
With fucking Michael Keaton and Emma Stone.
With Michael Keaton and Emma Stone.
And Jack Galifianakis.
Jack Galifianakis.
Yeah, the brother of Zach Galifianakis. Who knew his brother could act, his twin brother? I like to think that now I'm thinking of, like, Zach Galifianakis does have he does have a brother named Jack, and they just, like, looked exactly the same, so, like, half of his movies. Like, Zach Galifianakis didn't want to do the second two Hangovers.
He just got Jack.
He got Jack to do it.
That's beautiful. I love it.
Yeah.
That's anyway, what should happen all the time.
Yes, Zach Galifianakis is in it.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
And we're all happy with Birdman winning Best Picture, I'm assuming, right?
Yep. Definitely okay with that.
Yeah.
I was
it was a good movie.
And a good movie. Fucking go see it. Casey's not here to say fucking watch it already. Fucking watch it already, so I'll say it. Anywho, yep. God, this has been a long episode.
No kidding.
But it's been a fun one, right? We got to reconnect as alums, as graduates of college, as geeks at not college anymore.
Right? I feel like this episode should end with a song.
What song?
I don't know.